is the Savage Nation. Welcome, welcome, welcome. 1-800-449-8255 is the phone number from anywhere in the United States of America, including London. Michael Savage's favorite New Yorker profiles, I noticed, was covered in a blog note in the New Yorker itself. It's very interesting. The blogger writes, for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about myself as usual, because if I am not about myself, who will be? And yet if I am only about myself, who am I? So therefore, you have to indulge me. That's what talk radio is about. It's different than any other medium. In other avenues of the media, people try to bury themselves because that's the way it was done by gentlemen over the years. But the world is no longer gentle. And since there are very few men in the media, I'll do what I have to do to survive. Thank you very much. So the New Yorker wrote a profile of me, and I'm actually, it's changing something inside of me. I don't know exactly how yet. I feel something changing in me in some ways, and I have to take time to absorb what this actually means. I don't know whether you think the profile of me was good or bad, positive or negative, real or false. We can talk about that. Nevertheless, it's a milestone in my life and my career. Let's put it to you that way. It is a big deal for me because I grew up reading the New Yorker and profiles, in particular some of the profiles you wouldn't believe that I liked. And we read in today's New Yorker news desk, the blog site, notes on the day by the staff of the New Yorker, Michael Savage's favorite New Yorker profiles, and they say this, and it's very short. Then we're going to go into some other news stuff. On this week's New Yorker Out Loud podcast, I said to Kalefa Sena that I assumed that the conservative talk radio host Michael Savage, the subject of Sena's profile, was not a New Yorker subscriber. Sena corrected me. Savage is a long-time reader of the magazine. Savage confirmed this on the July 27 installment of a syndicated radio show, Savage Nation. Here's what Savage said. I'm reading as a kid now in college, and I'm seeing this profiles. I'm going to go back now to the early list. Profiles of people done by the New Yorker in the times that I was in college. Fellini, 1965. Bob Dylan, 1964. Albert Einstein, 1973. Dizzy Gillespie, 1990. Mort Saul, 1960. Stanley Kubrick is profiled in 1966. Buckminster Fuller is profiled in 1966. One of my favorite profiles, Savage said, was of a guy you never hear of named Joe Gould, who was a well-known Greenwich Village bohemian. I loved that profile so much, it actually stayed with me for ages for some reason. He goes on, he says, so count Michael Savage as yet another Joseph Mitchell fan, and I don't know who he is, I think he puts together the profiles. And he says, Savage Nation yesterday included long excerpts from the Out Loud podcast, which I'll admit sounds better with Savage chuckling underneath, knit together with discursions about Botox, flatulence, the theater, and whatever else came to mind. This was my favorite, he writes. Quote, Savage said, I ate too much radicchio last night, which is so acidic. I'll never eat it again. Can they serve me lettuce, for God's sakes? Why do I have to eat this stuff? Everything's a trick. When I grew up, it was vinegar. Now everything's a trick. Vinegar, it's now $5,000 a bottle, like wine. Why does everything have to be so special? You asked for a cup of coffee. You got coffee in my day. Now it's 50 different varieties. Same garbage with different prices. Macchiato, Lacamata, Lacawana, choo-choo. Savage urged his listeners to buy the current issue. I want them to understand we're conservative and we buy magazines. They are sold out in West Hollywood because friends of mine in Hollywood bought every copy available. They're sold out in San Francisco because they don't sell them in San Francisco. The illiterate left doesn't read the New Yorker in San Francisco. They only read periodicals that favor burning cars and things of that nature. But I'm pleased to report that at least one gentleman in the mainstream media has covered the disgrace of Michael Savage being banned in Britain. And that's a man named John O'Sullivan, who wrote an editorial in the New York Post. John O'Sullivan was once the editorial page editor of the New York Post. They posted his post called Condemned by Their Own Laptops at around 1 in the morning last night. You can't find it anywhere in the New York Post anymore because it's part of the conspiracy to ban any discussion of me by the new Soviet-era conservative press. I mean, we expect this behavior, don't we, from the liberal press, but you wouldn't expect it from the so-called conservative press, would you, when one of theirs is hanging by a thread that they would ignore him? Well, I would expect it because of reasons I have explained on this show over and over again, and I'm going to talk about it later on, but I want you to read Condemned by Their Own Laptops, New York Post, John O'Sullivan. You can find it on michaelsavage.com. I can't locate it on the New York Post at all. I want to read it to you. It's really good. The latest twist in the saga of how the British government banned talk radio host Michael Savage from entering Britain is straight out of the sitcom Yes, Prime Minister. in which a Machiavellian civil servant, Sir Humphrey, repeatedly manipulates PM Jim Hacker into foolish decisions with subtle arguments that Jim never quite grasps. Jim, so we're banning this fellow savage from Britain because he's a dangerous Islamic terrorist, are we? Sir H, not quite, PM. We're banning him because he isn't a dangerous Islamic terrorist. Jim, I see. No, I don't. Sir H, well, there are a lot of dangerous Islamic terrorists on the list already. It might give the impression we don't approve of them. So we're adding other names to, well, balance them out and, well, reassure them. Jim, balance, huh? So this savage is dangerous in other ways. Sir H, indubitably, PM, he's a conservative shock jock radio broadcaster. Jim, I don't know what that is, but it doesn't sound especially dangerous. Why did we say we're keeping him out? Sir H, consults document. I think the phrase is, quote, likely to cause community tensions, PM. Jim, is Savage likely to cause community tension? Sir H, not really, sir. Nobody in the community has ever heard of him. Both laugh. Jim, well, they'll hear of him once we ban him. They laugh again. Sir H, but it'll be for the one and only time. They fall over laughing. So then John O'Sullivan goes on with this great column, and he says, So it would have been if a shrewd old Mandarin like Sir Humphrey were still running the Home Office in Whitehall. He'd never have made the elementary error of putting the real reasons for banning Savage in a confidential email. He'd know that the final destination of confidential Labour government mail is the front page of the Conservative Daily Mail, which is where the internal Home Office emails relating to Savage's exclusion from Britain ended up this week. Savage himself is owed most of the credit for exposing this latest farce. He decided to fight his exclusion by launching a slander suit against the Home Secretary, the hapless Jackie Smith, who has since resigned amid an avalanche of gaffes, and then obtained his own list of incriminating emails as part of the legal process. These emails are fully as silly and damaging as anything in Yes, Prime Minister. One makes it explicit that Savage is being named as an excluded person, quote, simply to ensure that the names disclosed are not all Islamic extremists, close quote. Another email discovered reveals that the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, and the Foreign Secretary, David Miliband, are, quote, firmly behind this naming and shaming. A third email from a civil servant who seems a potential Sir Humphrey prudently warns his bosses that all this sounds too much like, quote, duplicity. Indeed, it does. The list of named and shamed included not only Islamic extremists, but also two Russian skinheads imprisoned for 20 racial murders. What had Savage done to justify including him in such company? The worst that the cautious Home Office official could cite was that he was, quote, homophobic, which isn't a crime even in San Francisco, the birthplace of Savage's radio show. And why proclaim his exclusion when he had shown absolutely no sign of wanting to enter Britain? The answer is that naming and shaming Savage was a low exercise in cheap politics, all too characteristic of the Brown government. Its methodology is similar to the recent scandal wherein a Gordon Brown aide had to resign on being found spreading false rumors, also via email, that opposition Tory leaders and their families were mired in various sexual sins. Those were false. You hear? It had another low political motive as well, as that of appeasing radical Islamism, namely attempting to discredit conservatives by associating them with extremists and political criminals. Exactly the same tactics, guilt by association and guilt by exclusion, were later used against Geert Wilders, the anti-immigration Dutch politician. Whatever flaws of taste or opinion they may have committed, that's Wilders and Savage, neither man posed any threat to security, the British way of life, or even community tension. Home secretaries, either Smith or her successor, would be well advised not even to attempt the robust defense their department promises in response to Savage's slander suit. They are condemned by their own laptops. All the same, it would be fun to see Savage being cross-examined by one of those clever British barristers. That's by John O'Sullivan in the New York Post, although you can't find it there anymore. It's on michaelsavage.com, entitled Condemned by Their Own Laptops. Although it would be fun to see Savage being cross-examined by one of those clever British barristers. Yeah, it'd be fun to hear the high-class accent trying to get the best of this shock jock, who too many people think is incapable of nuance and subtlety. Now, speaking of nuance and subtlety, I'm going to ask some questions on the Savage Nation that I think are nuanced and subtle. such as this. Why is it that the right wing in America generally never talks about arts, culture, science, poetry? Why is it that the right wing can only discuss politics to the exclusion of arts and culture? Do so-called conservative commentators today think that their audiences are so uneducated that they could not even discuss such matters? Or are these commentators, the right-wingers in America, just uneducated themselves and afraid to admit it? I have discussed, for example, my walks through great art museums. I've talked about scientific papers, whatever comes to my mind. I sometimes talk about the great novels of Western civilization. I talk about music, from jazz to the classics. And yet you never hear such topics coming out of the mouth of the golfer or the ears of the hemorrhoid. Why is that? I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Savage Nation. It's sort of like cheerleaders outside a sporting event, that bumper, you know. Isn't it? Baba baba boo, beba baba bee. It's, you know, it's already July 29th. Give me a break. Baba baba boo, beba baba bee. So here we are, condemned by their own laptops. It's a slam dunk case, or is it? And the New Yorker is a big deal. It's changing me in certain ways inside. In that, I think, to me, it's a milestone in my life. I can't explain how it's going to affect me. And only one person in the mainstream media has understood how important this British case is. Now, locally in San Francisco, a blogger named Big Vinny, who is a liberal apparently, has been covering this because he understands that it's a bigger issue than Michael Savage. New York, not one article written about me. It's funny, with all the big mouths in the media and all of the girls with Botox lips who care so much about the Constitution, who wrap themselves in just so many flags, it's hard not to notice their lipstick, because it blends in so well with the red stripes of the U.S. flag. How come none of them have seen fit to cover this? It's unbelievable to me. Vivian in New York City, go ahead, please. You saw it today in the New York Post. What page? Vivian, go ahead, please. Gone with the wind. Bingo. All right. 1-800-449-8255. We can move on. Support the Savage Legal Fund if you want. Madoff says, I pulled off the scheme because feds weren't watching. Now, here's what I want to know. Madoff says he was able to steal $65 billion because the feds weren't watching. Can anyone explain why not one Fed has been indicted yet? Answer, because they're working for Obama or one of the investment banks that got the money. They will all be at Martha's Vineyard this summer, high-fiving each other on a tennis court with Obama present. What, are you kidding me? We're living like in a banana republic right now. It's a small version of what's coming to this nation. We're becoming like a South American nation. The level of corruption has never been like this. It's like Diamond Jim Brady took over the White House. But, you know, okay, Madoff did this during other, you know, regimes. He did it during Clinton, during Bush. Didn't matter. He owned them. He smeared so much money around. What, Schumer didn't get any? You're telling me Schumer didn't get some of the spinoff of the Madoff scam? And that's why there's no investigation. Why is Chris Cox, for example, of the SEC, and I'm not accusing him of having taken any money or having done anything illegal at all. Why is it that Bush's head of the SEC, Christopher Cox, ex-Republican congressman, has not yet been indicted? Well, he's probably innocent. That's the only thing I can conclude. Innocent until proven guilty. Yeah, that's the American way, particularly if you own the government. The New Yorker article was a turning point for me in the sense that it was the first media depiction of Michael Savage that truly captured the artistry of Michael Savage as well as the polemics. While others focus solely on isolated polemics taken completely out of context, this article in the New Yorker captured in many ways the entirety of who I am as a talk show host and as a man. Now, what's interesting to me is there are some of you out there who refuse to believe that a left-leaning magazine such as the New Yorker could possibly do a fair job of covering me. So here would be my question to you. Do you think that the New Yorker profile has diminished my influence amongst my conservative base because it shows me as being a more whole man? Or do you think it's going to increase my audience to a larger level by pulling in some people from the other side? I don't know. I have something to admit to you, though. No, I want to go back to that for a minute. The left today controls the culture. But it's not a natural phenomenon that the left should own the culture. Why is it that the conservatives are sort of atonal when it comes to music, literature, science, poetry, art. Why is that? In other words, you rarely, if ever, hear a talk show host on the right discussing, I mean, we're not NPR, but there is a larger world than Obama, Marxism, etc., right? There's a larger world than talking about health care incessantly day in and day out. So what I'm saying is, as an educated man myself, I tend to occasionally talk about these things. Why is there almost no discussion of anything except these tinny little subjects by the golfer, by the wall banger, by the hemorrhoid? The answer is because they never went to college. Don't you understand? They're a stereotype of what the left says about them. They're not bad people, don't get me wrong, but they're incapable of anything else.
Savage.
It is a crazy, mad, mad world. There's no question about it. Everyone's out to get everyone else. And there's no friendship. That's the beautiful part. Once you know that, you're liberated. Everyone will disappoint you. Not because people are inherently bad, but because it's the fault of the apple, as was written by a fiction writer 40, 30 years ago. Goldman, was it Goldman who wrote it? The fault of the apple. He said it was the fault of the apple. He was so right. I'm guilty of it. I mean, I'm sure I disappoint everybody I know one way or the other. I try not to, but how can you not? How can you not disappoint somebody just being a human being and trying to get through a day? Right? So, you hear what we're talking about already on the show. The other night, last night I watched, remember I told you I was flying back from Florida and I bought the DVD set Mad Men Season 2? And I watched it till my eyes almost fell out, then I told the pilot, pull it out of the DVD player. So now we bought Season 1 of Mad Men. There's something weird about January Jones. In some scenes in Season 2, she's as gorgeous as Grace Kelly. And then there's some bad cuts where she gets a little puffy. She looks like a different person. She's almost like the three or four faces of Eve, that woman. She can range from superb, like high-class Connecticut woman. She's best when she puts on the riding uniform and goes riding in Connecticut. But there's some other scenes where she's so dowdy looking. I don't understand how she could be the same person. I mean, I'm not drawing a bigger conclusion here. I just don't understand as an actress how she can have so many faces. But then that opening scene, the graphics of Mad Men on AMC, where the graphics of the ad man falling out of the building, the cartoon. You know what I mean? Wow, that's really good. In that, you know, it was one misstep and you fell out of the you fell out of your career. But has anything changed from the days of the man in the gray flannel suit? Has anything changed in any business today related to the media? I have fallen out of a building 5 times now, and I'm still functioning. I can go back over my career. 5 times people have tried to throw me out of a window. I mean, you know, I don't mean throw me out of a window, literally, and no one's Superman. 5 times I bounced back to where I fell from. Or I climbed back, or I crawled back on the building with suction cups in my hands. What can I tell you? It's because it took me all my life to get there. No one's getting rid of me so fast. And many of them who try to get rid of me wound up getting rid of themselves, like Jackie Smith. She tried to push me out of a window, and right now she's out of the window. And I can name 5 other people in the media who went after me from day one in local stations who are no longer heard of. And I'm making a statement right now. Somebody up there likes me, number one, or I wouldn't be here, number two. And number three, all of you who are out to get me in the media, particularly you conservatives, I will outlive you in the media. I'm telling you right now, I'll be here long after you're gone. I may be 20 years older than you, but I'm telling you as I stand here, I'm going to be here long after you're gone. I'm making that commitment right now. Keep pushing, because you're only playing judo with yourself. You're going to wind up falling out of a window. New York City, WOR, 1-800-449-8255. Gabe, go ahead, please. You're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Mr. Savage, from formerly of Brooklyn, I live in Long Island now.
Yes, sir.
You just talked about the Jake Sullivan article.
Yes.
And I get 3 papers for the last 60 years. I get the...
So where is this article by John Sullivan condemned by their own laptops? Is it in today's Post? If it is, what page?
Page 29.
Where is it? Next to a Brazier ad or next to a... Where'd they bury it? Next to some, smut parlor in the Bronx?
Before you get to the editorial, the page...
Oh, shocking. Shocking. It slipped through the censors of the New York Post. How did that happen? Gabe, thanks for calling. That's all. San Diego, John, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Michael Savage in a British court. That would be great. That would be like a pay-per-view moment. I mean, I'd pay money to see that, like a UFC fight. You gotta promote it and make some money off it for
well,
you.
Well, I understand what they would try to do, because the opposition would try their Eton accents on me, thinking they're going to run a number by me that, you know, I sound like a longshoreman or a truck driver. I'm some just shock jock they're going to run over. And I know what would happen. These guys would be very embarrassed after the interchange.
All right.
No, I'll tell you, if we do the documentary movie on me, we'll film it in a British court if I get that far. Or we could put out, remember the thing with the French fries, we wouldn't eat them anymore? Remember that phase when the French were anti-American? How about putting out a product called Fish and Brits, where we get a mold and we cut potatoes in the form of little Brits and we fry them? That might be a big hit, Fish and Brits. Huh? Axelrod's son hired by Huffington Post. Ugh, God, take a look at this prize. You know who Axelrod is, isn't the guy with the mustache, the pencil mustache, who looks like a guy who works for the UJA from the Bronx? What kind of man has a son who has to go to work for Arianna Huffington when it isn't even her name? I mean, she took the name of the oil man that she married for his money, in my opinion. You know, what's her background in Greece? Does anyone know Arianna Huffington? She comes from Greece. Her family allegedly was anti-communist or anti-fascist. It's hard to say. But everybody knows that she was a woman who had cash registers in her eyes. Arianna Huffington was once a conservative when it suited her, and she married Mr. Huffington. He's a very nice man. I actually met him when I was a local talk show host, and he ran for governor, and he came in the studio. Very nice guy. I actually met her. She wasn't a bad person. And then she turned and wound up on Saturday Night Live, as long as I can remember. And she was on the air with Al Franken in bed playing some silly charade. And then she became a liberal because that's where the money was. That's the direction she went in. So now she has some kind of website that no one reads except diehards who look like the movie Pat. And now we realize that she hired one of Obama's minion's sons? Can you believe this? Yes, I could believe it. Where else could the kid work? I mean, McDonald's is full up. The illegal aliens have the jobs that he would normally get. New York City, WOR. Norm, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Mr. Savage. You were talking about why the Republicans don't seem to be talking about the arts.
Yeah.
I'm an artist in New York City. I'm also an art teacher. And I noticed that most of the artists on the grassroots level in the galleries, they all tend to be liberals, leftists. I'm rare among them. And you got the perfect example of 1937 when Johnny Rockefeller II, he hired this guy, Orozco, who was a painter, to do his mural in...
Rockefeller hired Rothko to do his murals? That's how he got to fame?
Well, no, he was top guy. So he hired a creative guy, and he tried to paint Lenin in one of those murals, which he did. These guys, the painters, tend to be leftists. The guys up on top who would give the grants, who spend the money, they tend to be mostly Republicans, are not too good in art, and they have a little bit of envy in them because they're not artists. So who runs?
Well, why don't the conservatives who have the money demand more from the artists? Why are all the artists so left-wing? Why is it that they don't understand the basics, which is that when repressive regimes arise, as they have in Venezuela, the artists suffer? Don't they put two and two together that the left today is the danger, that there is no right at all in this country? There's absolutely no right-wing government whatsoever. There's no right-wing waiting in the wings in this country. Where is it?
It's gone.
The Republican Party isn't the right-wing. They're the Republican Party.
Absolutely right.
The true party of liberation is a party of one. That's what I've been trying to say with my show for these years. A party of none is also a liberation, to not belong to either of these machines. Thanks for the call. Whatever. John in Connecticut, line 5, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Yeah, how you doing, Michael? One of the reasons why we don't listen to or expect to hear the arts and entertainment from you and others is basically we're getting from other places. And you know, I can get my arts and entertainment and go to museums and get that type of thing from other sources, and it's pretty unspinnable from my perspective. We listen to you for direct commentary on politics and finance and other things like that.
Okay, I understand that, but what if a person who is on the right side of the dial, as I am, goes to a museum or an art show and I talk about it. Why is that not of interest? In other words, seeing an art show from the conservative perspective, I'll give you an example. San Francisco once had a pretty good set of museums here. Most of them have been taken over by radical leftists who put on some of the most abominable exhibitions imaginable, such as a series of dresses and clothing worn by some old woman who had a lot of money. They actually put on an exhibit of the woman's shoes, her dresses, her clothing. And I went there, and I think rather hysterically ripped the exhibit apart. I thought that that was political and artistic.
I agree. I know there's a lot of other examples of that kind of garbage out there. And, I've heard about it in New York City. Occasionally there's been art shows where they've, we've heard all about them. But,
well, that's what I mean. I'm not going to just talk about art to sound intellectual or to sound like a pseudo-intellectual, but when they do an exhibit in a museum about a woman's shoes, I couldn't believe what I was looking at. And I said, this is an example of what's going on in museums today. Now, that's what I mean by covering the arts. Now, of course, in passing, I'll also talk about one of the finest oceanic collections in the world, which happens to be in the museum here, but the best one is in New York City, the Rockefeller collection. You've probably seen it yourself.
And we appreciate the interjection occasionally, but for the most part, mainly we're looking for, the direct...
All right, so what you're saying in a nice way is lay off the art crap and stick to politics.
I don't mind the art commentary occasionally, but I can get that from other places. What I can't get is direct commentary on politics. It's always spun in other places. That's why we come to you.
Listen, here's the thing. I come on late in the day in New York on the East Coast. I come on late afternoon in the Bay Area on the West Coast and in between the rest of the country. You've heard it all. Haven't you heard it by now from the golfer, the wall banger, and the hemorrhoid? Haven't you heard everything about health care, or you don't have the time to listen earlier? Is that what you're saying?
We get it a little bit, but you give us a little bit different perspective. We appreciate your perspective on things, the way that you bring in your background with the botany and things.
All right,
like
so
that.
You want me to focus almost entirely, as I've done for 15 years, on politics and lay off the other stuff?
Flavor occasionally, but I do appreciate
it. I hear you. I don't know if I can do it anymore, though. I'm making an admission, John. I think after 15 years of it, I'm bored of it. I find politics extremely boring. We know, look, let's talk about the basics. Obama is a Marxist. Everything about him, if it walks like a Marxist, if it talks like a neo-Marxist, it is a neo-Marxist. Why was it fair game to call conservatives who were behind Bush neocons? Why can't we call Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel and all of the others around Obama what they are, which is neo-Marxists? The answer is because we have no control over the print media in this country. They are neo-Marxists, period. I mean, the slur neocon went on for years when Bush was in power, right? Yet we now have a stalking horse communist regime running this country. Some of them are overt communists, some of them are mild communists, some of them are light communists. There's not one of them who is an American from my point of view. Every one of them is trying to disassemble this great nation. But I've said that over and over again, John. Thanks for the call. New York City, WOR, Mo, Schmo, you're on the Savage Nation, Mo.
Hi, Mike. I just wanted to ask why they call you a shock jock when all you do is tell the truth. Has the truth become so shocking?
Because in order to try to diminish what power I have, whatever power I may have, in order to diminish the intelligence that I may show on this show from time to time, they have to try to marginalize me by calling me a shock jock, but I've taken it as a joke now. I said, Gad, call me shock jock, see if I care. Call me shock jock at the risk of your own embarrassment. That's all I can say. And by the way, when have you last seen a shock jock profiled in the New Yorker? Have you ever seen one profiled yet?
I have to tell you that I don't have television by my own choice. And
again,
I
no answer. Wait, hold on. Do I have bad technology? Can you answer the? No one hears me. I found it yesterday. I listened back to the show. I torture my family by making them listen to the replay. when I say something to a caller, they don't hear me. There must be a delay running the other way or something. I have the longest time delay in the history of radio. Most people have 7 seconds, then they made it 16 seconds. I think now the time delay is 30 seconds. So I think it feeds back the other way, too. I'm not sure. I really don't know what the issue is. I say A, they're talking about C. I say C, they're talking about A. 1-800-449-8255. Okay, condemned by their own laptops. That's the latest twist in the saga of how the foolish British government banned talk radio host Michael Savage from entering Britain. It's an article you should print in the New York Post. It's on michaelsavage.com. And this piece shows the Machiavellian duplicity of these bumbling socialists in England. And let me tell you something, the Obamaites are not far behind. I'll be right back. All right, you want some breaking news? I mean, it came out a little bit ago. No health care reform vote before autumn. Obama has got egg all over his face. Pelosi has egg all over her face. They lost. They were lying up until the other day saying that they got the votes. Rahm Emanuel's going to ram it. She's got the votes, Miss Botox. BS, they lost. It's over. We've missed the communist bullet for now. Okay, because remember what I said to you. The number one centerpiece of any communist administration is health care for all. Because you don't understand yet why this is so important to Marxists. Castro did it. One of the first things Fidel Castro did after taking over Cuba was he promised health care for every Cuban, and he delivered. The problem is it's terrible health care. Terrible health care where the elites don't use that health care. The elites either fly to Venezuela or Miami or Spain or fly in doctors from NYU to take care of them. They wouldn't use a Cuban doctor. That's what's going to happen to this country. But you got to ask yourself, why do dictators want socialized medicine? Answer, power, power, power. There's tons of money to be stolen, yes. Medication, double billing, transportation, triple billing. Their friends get the ambulance, whatever. It's unlimited, the amount of money they can steal from the average schmuck taxpayer. But that's not the real reason. Power, power, power. They control you from cradle to grave. They know what medications you're on. Any bureaucrat anywhere can hit a button and access your confidential medical records. I don't understand how the left, which is so obsessed with medical privacy, hasn't said one word about this government medicine. Don't they understand that they're going to lose all privacy whatsoever? There's zero, and no one's discussed it but me. I'm the only person in the media. I know that's why you want to listen, why you listen to me and why you want me to talk about it. Sure, my perspective is a little different. You've heard a thousand things about costs. They're all correct. But Obamacare has a more sinister danger to it, which is the loss of medical privacy. Any bureaucrat anywhere at any time could press a button and find out your entire medical history. They don't like you, they could pull it. They don't like you, they could see what medication you're on. They don't like it, they could pull your psychiatrist or your shrink's notes about you. I don't care what they say. You know and I know they'll do it. And they'll do it strictly to control you. And I am telling you, this is the single biggest fear that we should all have with a centralized Soviet-era bureaucracy controlling our medication and our medical care from cradle to grave. They lost. They were pushing as hard as they could. Obama tried in the first 6 months to literally stranglehold every aspect of this economy. He did more than Chavez did in Venezuela in a shorter period of time. I told you that. He went faster than Chavez did. Only you didn't see it because little men like Wolf Blitzer work for him. They work for him knowingly. Little men without sexual parts are the minions of this administration. Beware the government media complex. You get it? So Obama lost. Now they're saying no health care reform vote before autumn. Where's Pelosi now that she's lost? And they're going to try a spin on it? It's over. Because what's going to happen is now the lawmakers, who are real lawmakers, mainly those from the Midwest, the so-called blue dogs, the blue dog Democrats, the conservatives who are one-termers unless they crack down on this communism, they're going through bills in both houses of Congress with fine-tooth combs. We know that they are opposed to Obamacare because the costs are unsupportable. It's an unsustainable bill. We understand that. So we won. We won. Obama lost. Obama lost. So say one for the USA and zero for Obama. Say one for the USA and zero for Nancy Pelosi. Because let me tell you, as far as I'm concerned, they're on the other team. They're playing for the other side. They're playing for worldwide socialism. And I don't have any other words for them other than what I've given you about them. So the big news is no health care reform vote before autumn. And I say, even if you're for health care reform, what's wrong with studying what's in those 1,000 pages? The answer is nothing. Good. We won. They lost.
Savage.
Condemned by Their Own Laptops by John O'Sullivan, New York Post. Don't miss it. It's on michaelsavage.com, and I guess it's in the New York Post as well. It's really well written. At last, the logjam has broken in the midstream media. It's only a matter of time until one of the lipstick girls on Fox News realizes that the way to separate themselves from Scarface is to actually start doing journalism. And one of them will have me on one of their shows. That's if I'm available. But let me tell you something. This story about Britain banning me simply to balance out radical Islamists is such a gigantic story in the media that those who cover it are going to be rewarded, and those who have ignored it are going to wind up on the ash heap of media history. When the history is written of what went on, and I'm not going to be writing it, someone's going to be writing it, and those who covered it, I'm telling you, are doing themselves a favor. Not because they like me, but because they understand the good story and how important the story really is. And those who refuse to cover it are putting themselves into the ash heap of history. No one's putting them there. Okay, so now let's move on. The New Yorker's still a big deal for me. The thing is out. It's selling out across America, so far as I could tell. Because I bought 100,000. No, I did buy 100 copies. I haven't bought it in many years, but I did buy 100. Why shouldn't I have 100 copies? I want to give them to all 99 grandchildren of mine who I don't have. New York City, WOR. Barbara, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, I think that the article in the New Yorker is going to benefit you very, very much. The author very realistically portrayed you as the man that you are. You're what I would call fair and balanced. And you sort of come across as a lovable curmudgeon, which is the way you do come across a lot of times. I can be.
I can also be just an unlovable curmudgeon, depending upon the day and where you catch me. But it's not really so much about who I am. It's really more about the art form of talk radio, I think.
Well, it's giving a side of it that people, other people hadn't known about, I think, and they're going to read this, because I've been reading the, I'm your age, I'm 67, I've been reading the New Yorker since I was in high school, and I feel the same way about the magazine as you do, except I've been disappointed with their liberal leanings for quite a while.
But that's true with all of the print magazines, which is why many of them are diminishing in sales. It's one of the reasons. I keep saying it's not just about diminishing advertising revenue, which is a factor. It's because the audience that would be naturally buying these magazines generally is more conservative than the editorial policies of these magazines, so people don't want to contribute to it.
I know, I agree. It's not just their advertising revenue going down, it's the content. And
right, why pick up a magazine that continuously slams everything you believe in? And lauds everything that you know to be culturally degenerate. That's really what people are thinking. Barbara, thank you for calling the Savage Nation. Let's go to Washington, D.C., one of the hundreds of stations that I'm fortunate enough to have on the Savage Network. WTNT in Washington, D.C. Sharon, thanks for calling. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, do not give in to that draconian caller that said, don't talk about art. I live for those moments when you talk about art. You're the only one on talk radio that does, the only one that does, and we love you. You are just...
See, the women, but you're one of the 12 women Savagettes across America. There's only, of the 8 to 10 million listeners, there are 12 women listeners. You're one of the 12.
I love you.
I love sometimes women come up to me and they smile and they say, I'm one of the 12 Savagettes in America. You know, women have a sense of humor that I think is a little different than men. Not that men don't, but I think women are a little more giving with their humor. Thank you so much for that call. I'm getting more PC. As I say, how nice I use the word so much. That's like a thing going around for 2 years now, like a virus. It started about 3 years ago in West L.A. I heard it from callers out of Los Hollywood. When they'd say in that saccharine way, thank you so much, that 901-0209 kind of so much thing, that kind of Marin County hug with the hips out backwards so then there's no sexual content. You know, that saccharine, thank you so much. That went around for a while. I'm capable. I'm learning. There's a few words I have not, I've chosen never to use. I don't like the word cool. I won't use it because I used it when I was 18. Like, that's cool, that's cool, that's cool, that's cool, that's cool, that's cool. Mainly uncool people use the word, that's cool. I don't use it, I don't smoke them, I don't talk them, and that's, I don't need them. Never smoked them, whatever, never toked them. San Francisco, David, San Francisco, welcome, KNEW Land, what's on your mind?
Hey, Michael, I was at a bookstore, magazine store yesterday, buying a copy of The New Yorker, and a guy was in there, and he says, "Oh, my God, another right-winger in San Francisco? I can't believe it." So we
Wait. You mean about you buying The New Yorker?
Yeah.
Well, how did he know you were buying it to read about Michael Savage?
I just asked the clerk. I said, "Do you have the new New Yorker?" He says, "Yeah." And the guy says, "Oh, I'm looking for that, too, to read a story about Michael Savage." I said, "Oh, yeah." So I heard the webcast. I thought it was great. I thought the article was fantastic. Did a great job. I think he knows.
So the distinguished book clerk sneered at you?
No, he didn't sneer at me. He just kind of smiled. He knew that there were two right-wingers in there.
Oh, wait, you're saying he actually was on the right?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm overly defensive. Pardon me.
The other patron that was in the store was the one that says, "Oh, another right-winger in San Francisco." And the
clerk, what, it's illegal? It's illegal to be a right-winger in San Francisco? When did it become illegal?
Yeah, he said, "Well, I guess we're going to have to cover our faces when we leave the store."
Maybe they could put you in a pillory in San Francisco if you don't adhere to the Communist Party line.
Got it. Anyway.
All right, thank you for doing that. The real Michael Savage, Kalefa Sena on a Shock Jock's Unexpected Side. It's on the front flap, along with Healthcare Hypochondria, Lost in Siberia, and Will the Kindle Kill the Book? I don't even know what a Kindle is. A Kindle, when I was a child, was a child who lit a candle, a Kindlach. A Kindle? Kindle is a candle. Why did they have to change everything on me? Will the Kindle Kill the Book? A Kindle, apparently, is an e-book that you can download for a fee from one of the sites. I don't know. I'm going ahead and printing books still like it's yesterday. I still live in the age of the Gutenberg Press, which is 1999. You know what I mean? To me, when I hold a book, a book is still real to me. I mean, I read the internet incessantly. I ruined my eyes from it, but I grew up reading books. I grew up reading papers. I grew up reading magazines. And to me, they still have a power and a magic. They do. So when I self-published Psychological Nudity, and I went out of my way to get a high-quality cover and a high-quality, I picked the type and I picked the paper. I made it good paper. It has a magic to me. I don't know, a Kindle downloading it. Okay, that's a new way. I could sell a book on my website that way, I suppose. But I'd rather you take the book home and see Teddy and I. 1-800-449-8255. I don't know. I can't really grip today. I can't catch today. I'm trying to catch today. You know how they say seize the moment, seize the day. And I'm going to tell you something about talk radio as an art form. Some days I come into the studio, one of the many studios I come into, and I can literally seize the electrons in the air. I can grab them, I can condense them, and I could throw them out through this microphone like Shazam bolts into your ears. I can't do it today. I don't know why. I don't know what it is. There's something going on in me that has to do with the New Yorker article. I got to tell you, let's talk about that for 3 minutes. Because I don't want to overplay it, but on the other hand, I don't want to underplay it. I know I've been going on and on about it for 3 days. Let me explain what's going on inside of myself so I can understand it myself. Because talk radio for me is somewhat of a confessional booth. You know, a Catholic goes into a confessional and talks to the priest through the, right? In some ways, talk radio to me is this confessional booth. I'm certainly not every little intimate detail of my life am I going to talk about on the air. I'd be insane. But on the bigger issues, I find that talk radio to be quite therapeutic, and it helps me formulate some of my thoughts, the way I express, I'm forced in the moment to express them to you. So let me deal with this, okay? Just as the Catholic is reluctant to lie to his priest, and the Jewish person is reluctant to lie to his cardiologist, I am reluctant to lie to my audience. That's a joke. I made it up the other day. I saw my cardiologist in the mall, and I made it up for him. He laughed hysterically. It is funny. You know, for a shock jock, I do quite well. I mean, I realize I only have a half a brain compared to the geniuses on the left who love Karl Marx and Che Guevara, but I do the best I can in my own limited way. So, okay, here's what's going on. So the New Yorker article comes out, and I have a letdown, an exhaustion. A malaise sweeps over me. Did you ever get one of those days where your head's foggy? You can't go into radio any day with a foggy head. You can't do it. It'd be like trying to fly a plane, and you should call in sick that day. a fog comes over my eyes. I've gotten these in the allergy season where I can hardly perform, but I've pushed through it. Whatever, a lot of, you know, a lot of caffeine, a lot of caffeine. Sometimes I'll even eat chocolate, which is a disaster for me. But I can't do that right now. So I go on the air, and I, like yesterday, I'm unfocused. I do a fairly good show. But I get off the air, I'm dead. I'm just dead. I can hardly move. I feel like a disease has overtaken me. An exhaustion. So thoughts are, let's see. I've had so much bad news for so long, and I so feared that the New Yorker article would come out and be another blow that I was ready for, right? I mean, I had 3 months of the worst months of my adult life now, unrelenting. Now, I got to tell you, it's having a very bad effect on me. You look at World War II. Don't laugh, by the way. 7 days a week, 24/7 under siege. All of those men who fought that war, most of them got very, they didn't live too much longer after World War II. These 3 months have almost, okay, they've taken a lot out of me. I won't quit. I'm a fighter. I will fight until, like Jackie Smith's gone, I'm going to fight until my name is exonerated and I win my reputation back and I win back my legal costs at the very least. I'm not quitting. Don't get me wrong. But it takes, you know, something out of me. I can pace myself. Okay, so now I'm ready for battle every day. So I know the New Yorker article was supposed to come out 2 months ago because he did this interview last, I don't remember when. It was in April, I think. Came out here, we did it. We thought it'd be out in May, then it wasn't in May, then we thought June, then this thing happens to me. It's going on and on and on and on, the English thing, and every day I'm expecting a New Yorker article, I'm saying, okay, it's not bad enough that they've slandered me in England, putting me in with murderers and terrorists, and it probably came from someone in the Obama administration from Chicago, one of those wonderful, excellent people who took sound bites out of context, but now the New Yorker's going to come out, and if it's another blow, I said, I can take it, but I don't need it right now. So now the article comes out, and I like it, because the man sees the artist behind the polemics rather than just the polemicist behind the art. You understand that? It's all a matter of set and frame. If you studied Psychology 101, there was a basic lesson in set and frame. What is the set? What is the frame? And unfortunately, we live in a society where people have reversed the set and frame. I'll be right back. It is the Savage Nation. You're listening to the music of Rammstein, which is good. Nine. My lucky number, nine. All right, turn it off. Now, let's move on. Let me finish that last monologue. So I'm telling you what happened. The article comes out in the New Yorker. I'm expecting the worst because I'm defensive about the media, and I had no idea which way it was going to go. And the reason I agreed to the interview was because I knew he was going to do it anyway. And I figured, you know, I know one thing about myself, which is that no matter what people think of me from a distance, when they meet me and spend time with me, they come away with a different view because I'm not what they heard about. I'm a different person. They have no idea the depth of my background, my learning, etc., nor the humanity that they feel. So anyway, I say, I'll take a chance. Guy comes out, blah, blah, blah. I liked him. I didn't know whether it was going to be good or bad. I had no idea. My instincts were take a chance on the guy because he was, listen to why. He was a jazz writer for the New York, the journalist, whatever you want to call him. He was a jazz writer for the New York Times for 7 years. Now, anyone who writes on jazz is a man who listens to the music. So anyone who has an ear to listen to jazz is capable of understanding subtlety, capable of understanding chord changes, variations. So I figure, okay, if he's listening this carefully to my show, his appearance, as his emails seem to reflect, then he'd be hearing me. And I was right, don't you understand? I took a chance, gambled on a human being, and I was right. It wasn't a hit piece. But the way it left me was like I fell off Mount Olympus. Or it's more like the myth of Sisyphus in reverse. I got to the top, instead of having pushed the rock up again, I fell down the other side.
Savage.
One third of the entire Recovery Act is for tax relief for you. You may not notice it, but a third of it is going to tax breaks to individuals and small businesses. That's money in your pocket to buy cupcakes and other necessities of life.
Well, Gallup says Obama hits new low. That we know. And the vote on the health care, meaning socialized medicine, is going to October. Nancy Pelosi lost. He lost. Rahm Emanuel lost. The guy with the mustache, who looks like he's from the UJA, lost. It's unbelievable to me how they're going to try and spin this. The American people have just missed an 88-millimeter, you know, howitzer shell coming at them. They missed it. It misfired. And his disapproval rating is in the toilet. It's gone down. Demographic groups. Obama approval slips 3 points in 1 week. Now, that's according to Gallup. And that's obviously because the man has bitten off more than he can chew. He's pushed the country too far to the left too fast. He's not giving people a chance to absorb what he's doing so they can decide for themselves. He's trying to be a dictator. And the people don't like dictators, whether they're on the left or the right. The American people are a fair-minded people. They don't like dictators, no matter how many spinmeisters they may have in the media. They don't like dictators. And in this case, he lost. You know what I'm saying? Military planning for possible H1N1 outbreak provides support for large-scale testing. Hell no, we won't go. I am not going to permit the government to test me for the flu. I would go to jail before I'd let them do that. I'll tell you right now. I don't trust them. I don't trust Big Sis. Because I wrote Big Sis as a miss a long time ago. It's being used by everyone now. I love Napolitano urges collective fight against terrorism. There is no terrorism. I actually fear the Homeland Security Department more than I do terrorists right now. I have more of a fear of big government than I do of Al-Qaeda. I didn't say that there aren't Al-Qaeda operatives that would like to hurt, that would like to hurt us. I agree there are. But we have the FBI, we have local police. This gargantuan agency called Homeland Security, to me, under this woman, frightens me. And as I remind you, we're not supposed to be frightened of this government, of any government. I told you that after the firebombing of Dresden in World War II by Allied bombers, the reason the German people didn't turn against the Nazi regime, historians say, is because they feared their own government more than they did Allied bombs. Now, if you want to live in a country where you fear your government more than you do Al-Qaeda, you could count me out. Right now, it might be 50-50. I'm not so sure I trust this government very much. I don't like where they're coming from. I don't like them targeting returning veterans. I don't like them targeting people who went to tea parties. I don't like them naming people who are anti-abortion. It bothers me very deeply that we have an administration that is so out of touch with the majority of American people that they dare target them as potential terrorists, my friends. So, therefore, I am. I speak, therefore, I am. 1-800-449-8255. What would you like to talk about? They lost, we won. I'm not so sure that when this comes up in October, it's going to even resemble what Obamacare is right now. I don't think that they're going to get this through in any way, shape. It'll be a modified health care reform package. Can anyone listening to this show honestly tell me that they personally want to see their taxes go up to provide health care, 100% gold-plated health care for illegal aliens? Do you know that the Democrats insisted that illegal aliens be included in any new health care reform package? Can you believe the nerve of these people and the insanity of these people that they would so cater to La Raza like this? What nation on earth can survive with dunces like this? The answer is none. Thank God the people spoke. I only wish that we had a parliamentary system and the government would have to hold elections right now. I'm not sure Obama could win. Did you hear what I said? If we still had a Republican Party with a scintilla of conservatism in it, I'm pretty sure the Obama administration could not win if the election were held today. And I'll put that to you right now. I would say that there's more voter remorse with this man than with any other president in modern history, because there was a greater con in getting this guy over the finish line than with any president in history. Never before has anyone seen a con like this. Think about it. You never heard of him 2 years ago. Unknown, radical left-wing senator from Chicago. Unknown. Where did he come from? Oh, he cured polio. He cured cancer. He was a combat veteran in Iraq who won the Silver Star, a Silver Star and a Bronze Star. He did nothing. The man put posters on telephone poles as a community activist. He was a front man for the Chicago Daily Machine, according to everyone who knows what's going on and who's in the White House. So now everyone's slowly catching on. When I say everyone, I don't mean the diehard Democrats. I don't mean the illegal aliens. I don't mean the government workers themselves. I don't mean the special interests who want to see the man thrive. I mean everyone in the independent column who will determine this election. There were probably at least 5 million potential Republicans who turned away from the Republican Party because of McCain. If they had run anyone who was conservative, they would have won. They didn't want Obama. It was a vote against McCain. McCain was a hack. McCain was Bush 2. McCain was a fraud. McCain the shame. McCain McShame. You know, you want me to relive that for you? I can't relive it for you. I did it too many times already on the show, and I don't want to do it anymore. In fact, I'd rather go back to the myth of Sisyphus for 1 minute, because I started it before the last break. So I said to you, so when the New Yorker article comes out, it's more like the myth of Sisyphus in reverse, where in the myth of Sisyphus, a man is condemned to a hell where he has to push a large boulder up a mountain every day, only to see it roll down the other side, and then he has to go down to the other side and push it back up to the top, and he does that for eternity. That's the myth of Sisyphus. It was popularized by Albert Camus in one of his short books in the 50s, The Myth of Sisyphus. But it has great meaning to people who are productive, because it feels like we're rolling boulders up against a large incline every day, only to see it fall down the other side, having to roll it up the other side the next day. Now, New Yorker comes out, it's as though I pushed the boulder. It did go down the other side, but it pulled me down, number one, and I don't have to push it up anymore. Because I'm through. I ain't going there. I'm not pushing up. No more boulders for me. That's what I'm getting at. That's why I was exhausted yesterday. It's like I'm on a plateau and I'm staying here. I'm going to beat them in Britain. With your help, with listeners like you, with contributors like you, with the momentum I have going, with what's coming out, with the article that just came out of the New York Post, condemned by their own laptops, with the discovery process, I am going to win. I already won in the court of public opinion. And those who have lined up against me are going to regret it, not because of me, but because their own audiences are going to recognize that there's something stinks in them. And those who came out of my side are going to win because their own audience understands fairness. Now, I asked Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State to write a letter on my behalf. She has a job as Secretary of State to represent any American who was unfairly imprisoned or unfairly accused by a foreign government. She did not even respond to my letter. I am telling you as I stand here, she still has a chance to win over those millions of middle-of-the-roaders who don't know which way to turn. She could show she's fair. She could even say, although I detest the man's politics, or I don't agree with any of his politics, or I just blah, 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 as a Secretary of State, I'm obliged to represent him, and I will, and I'm going to intervene on behalf of Michael Savage. But she hasn't done it, and it's going to cost her in the next election. Because as sure as I'm standing here, she's waiting in the wings to run in the primaries against Obama, and she'll do so very quickly. There's no question that the Clinton machine is waiting in the wings for Obama to slip, and boy, has he slipped. And that's why she's been such a terrible Secretary of State. She's taken virtually one bad position after another. She said nothing while Iran was killing and beating protesters. She did nothing while North Korea was lobbing rockets into the Pacific Ocean. She has done nothing but alienate the folks who support Israel. And therefore, she's not doing a very good job in terms of her future, as far as I could see. The best thing she could do for her political future, if I were advising her, one of the best things she could do is take my case, run with it, and make the Brits drop it against me. They're going to do it anyway. She could get the credit for it. So, again, I appeal to Hillary Clinton for her own Machiavellian reasons. She should represent Michael Savage in his attempt to clear his name, because his name is clear. If you remember now, Jackie Smith has fallen off the mountaintop. She fell out of the 31st floor. She lost her job. The Brown administration in England is about to go. The Conservatives are about to be swept in. What in the world does Hillary Clinton have to gain by continuing not to support Michael Savage? Nothing. Her base is not going to leave her because she supported me. She could spin it as a free speech issue, which it is, and continue to have her base. They're not going to turn on her any more than a New Yorker reader is going to stop buying the magazine because they ran an article about me in a profile called Party of One that wasn't too condemning. You understand what I'm saying? The people are not that stupid, as the dumb pollsters may have you believe. You get it? 1-800-449-8255. San Francisco, KNEW Reed. Welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Mike, good afternoon to you. Mike, when you speak about the disenfranchised voter, the one that voted not so much for Obama, but voted against the McCain and against the status quo, you're speaking to me. You're also speaking to a lot of my readers. This is R. Martin Basso, the author. And
I'm sorry, repeat your name again.
This is R. Martin Basso, the author. And I wanted to reach out to you finally and say thank you for verbalizing a lot of where we have come as a country. I went ahead and pulled, I as best as I could, I made a lot of arguments during the campaign season for in favor of the change in the status quo. I myself am a conservative of mindset, not so much a vote for Obama, and I'm ashamed to say now that I had voted for him.
But you encourage people to vote against the status quo of the Republican Party on the assumption that they'd get the message and they'd produce a conservative candidate. But it hasn't happened yet, has it?
It's not going to, Mike.
No, it's not going to happen. They're incapable of it. They are incapable of it. They have blocked conservatives. They're going to block conservatives. The only hope for America is a third party, a conservative party. I can't do it. Nationalist Party could have won. A new nationalist party that I would have organized, and if I was 20 years younger, I could do it. I could have won easily. I absolutely could run against any Democrat and win for any Senate seat in this country. But, A, I'm not going to do it because I have no desire to be in politics. But I would like to see a young returning Iraqi war vet who's literate and educated run on a conservative ticket. But the Republicans would undermine him. They'd cut his legs out from under him.
And I'm so tired of the liberals jumping on the bash Reagan bandwagon, just as I'm so tired of the quote-unquote conservatives jumping on the embrace Reagan bandwagon. They're both wrong.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what's going on now. You got the illiberal left attacking Palin, making me squirm because it's a cheap shot picking on her over and over again. It's embarrassing. It's sophomoric. It's childish. You know, you see it mainly on MSNBC where the losers continuously pick on her as though it's a joke. Now, I don't happen to like Palin as a political front runner, but I don't think she deserves that kind of treatment. I don't know how else to put it. I think that Palin undermined McCain. I think that his one strong card was experience versus Obama's inexperience. And whoever advised him to pick Palin was undermining him because he was shooting himself in the foot by picking an inexperienced, unknown VP. Nobody wanted that. That's what happened. I remember what happened. His poll numbers collapsed. And I'm convinced as a result of that choice that he was run by people who ran McCain to lose. And that's the way the system is, Reed. Thank you for the call. 1-800-449-8255. I'll be right back.
I belong to the prophets, man. I got tattoos on my soul, man. I got tattoos on my brain. I don't need any tattoos on my skin, man. I got gang tattoos on my soul.
Okay, that was put together for your listening pleasure here on the Savage Nation, something that's a little unique. That occasionally pops up out of my brain stem. I thought that was cute. The guys put music to it. I hope you enjoyed the Prophet Gang or the PGs or the GPs. I think that's what separates the talkers from the squawkers. I'm sorry. Oh, it's a long day's journey into night every day lately, isn't it? If I was a psychiatrist, I'd take off all of August. But I'm not going to take. I mean, you know, the end of August at the Hotel Ozone was an art film of the 1960s. I never forget that title, The End of August at the Hotel Ozone, which is exactly what this show has always been like for me in August. It's so different, August. No one's around. They are around. Those who are around are bored out of their minds. You know, most of the audience is somewhere else, wishing they weren't. But you look around, anyone who's in the media who can sustain themselves stays in the media. They don't leave. What do they need a vacation for? What are they going to find in Martha's Vineyard that they don't have on the radio or on the television? Tell me. What's waiting for them in Martha's Vineyard? To rub shoulders with the biggest crooks of our time? What, do you want to play frisbee with the biggest thieves in the history of the world? Making believe they're nice guys because they're liberals? The robber barons of today, they all congregate in Martha's Vineyard. One green mailer after another. One shyster after another. One would be made off after another, but they're such made men in terms of the government that you're never going to even hear of them. G5s fly in, G550s fly in. Anyone with less than a G5 is not even allowed into the top guy's house. have to park in Connecticut, and as a matter of fact, if they don't have a G5, they can't even land it on Martha's Vineyard. So, I mean, what's on a vacation? I don't know. And when you're young, a vacation is terrific. Well, if you have young children, I could see it. A grown-up doesn't need a vacation. A grown-up can have a vacation in his own mind. That's the vacation. Or unless it's, okay, so it's hot? Yes. So you go where it's cool. I understand that. That I understand. That's one thing. But all vacations are factory work. Toot, toot. Whistle blows. You got 2 weeks off, you know, for the holiday, so to speak. You go to Mallorca? What, are you a Brit all of a sudden? You're flying to Mallorca with the family? You're going to drink too much, eat too much, mabriashi? That's the stuff? I mean, what are you going to do there? You're going to eat squid? Calamari? I mean, what are you going to do on your vacation? I don't know. I don't know what people do. Everyone has a different thing. But if you got young kids, yes, I can understand it. Take them somewhere where they want to go, or you want to expose them to art. I can understand that. Or a wedding you can go to. Told you when I was young and traveling on the MV Waterman, my big trip to Europe, after college, during college. It was a former troop ship in World War II. They converted it to a college boat. The greatest fun I ever had in my life was on that ship. We'd drink all night, and we would sleep all day. What fun. Those were the days. So many characters. God, I can't even remember them. Where they are today, I don't know. But the people I looked up to on that ship as like giants of the arts probably were never heard from. You know what I'm saying? When you're young, everything's upside down. You think you're nothing and they're something. It turns out they're nothing and you're something. I remember there was a guy, Andrew. I thought he was so smart because he had like a weird sense of humor. He sounded like he was on MSNBC today where, you know, sarcasm and irony passes for intelligence. But he did it so well. He was rich. He went to a boarding school, and he grew up with that snotty attitude. And I kind of loved him because I thought he was so clever. I don't know if he ever amounted to anything, but I did, and he didn't. I would have heard of him if he did. But the point I'm getting is that was a vacation. There's no such thing as that anymore, you know, to me. But if you're on a vacation, God bless you. If you got a quest coming up, if you enjoy it, it's good for you. Just not good for me. I'm going to be here is what I'm saying. So get ready for a long August. Because Michael Savage is going nowhere. Remember, I'm a member of the PGs or the GPs. Here for you on your local station.
Savage.
You know, the New Yorker article is a turning point for the Savage Nation and myself. It's the first media depiction of Michael Savage that truly captured the artistic side of this polemicist. While others focused only on isolated statements or the polemics, taken completely out of context in most cases, the New Yorker profile, I believe, captured the entirety of who I am as a performing artist and talk show host. Of course, I know that there are some of you out there who refuse to believe that a left-leaning magazine such as the New Yorker could possibly do a fair job of covering me, so here's my question. Do you think the New Yorker profile diminishes my influence among my conservative base or increases my audience to an even larger level? There's another media outlet, this time a major investigative television news show, that has expressed interest over the last few months in doing an in-depth piece on me. Now, keep in mind, this is a different kind of outlet. They aren't focused on art and culture as the New Yorker is. They're better known for investigative journalism and expose. So I'll ask you another question. Do you think I should agree to an interview with this TV show? Should I take the opportunity for more publicity on my British case now that the media seems to be interested? Or is it too dangerous since they'd only be looking to, well, throw mud in my face? Why is it that the conservative side of the band avoids discussing arts and culture and almost exclusively does polemics, that is politics, 100%? Do so-called conservative commentators today think that their audiences are so uneducated that they couldn't discuss such matters? Or are these commentators so uneducated themselves and so afraid to expose it? You know, I've discussed my walks through great art museums in San Francisco. I talk about the great novels of Western culture. I talk about history. Why do you think that you never hear about such topics from the golfer or the hemorrhoid with eyes? What do you hear when you turn on conservative talk radio? What do you see when you turn on the fixed news? Well, what do you listen to when you see conservative commentators such as the hemorrhoid with eyes and the leprechaun? By and large, it's the same thing over and over again. Democrats bad, Republicans good. Obama's trying to impose socialism, but the heroic conservatives will save you from it. Obama is a racist. Liberals are attacking our values over and over and over again. Now, I'm not saying that they're wrong about any of this. Don't get me wrong. But talking about nothing else day in and day out is B-O-R-I-N-G, D-E-P-R-E-S-S-I-N-G, and M-A-D-D-E-N-I-N-G. What goes on within the tiny confines of Washington, D.C., and even within the world of politics is just a tiny sliver of the human experience. So in a very real way, all of these conservative talk radio programs and cable news shows have become somewhat inhuman. That's right, inhuman. I can't do inhuman. I'm Michael Savage. I'm a real human being, let us say, boils and warts and all. I refuse to talk about just politics. I can't do it anymore. I won't do it anymore. I must talk about the whole depth and breadth of the human experience. I was talking with someone today, and he told me that in the early 1990s, he used to listen to Rush Limbaugh and thought he was entertaining. But once Bill Clinton got elected, he couldn't listen to Limbaugh anymore because he wouldn't talk about anything that wasn't going on in Washington, D.C. In other words, the person heard Limbaugh becoming shallow and superficial, and he stopped listening. And I think that's what's happening to the conservative band right now. The Irish potato famine in the 1850s, which caused so many Irish people to move to the United States, was caused by the fact that the British forced the Irish to plant only one type of potato because it was convenient for commercial purposes. So when a disease spread through the potato plants in Ireland, nearly all the potatoes were wiped out. Why? Because they were genetically identical and had no resistance. It was a monoculture that could not adapt to change. Today, it seems to me, conservative commentators have become a media monoculture developed for commercial purposes only. And if they can't expand beyond Democrats bad, Republicans good, Palin a victim, then they will be wiped out by the indifference of the public. There's some amazing stories on my website, michaelsavage.com. John O'Sullivan's editorial in the New York Post, buried, by the way, is entitled Condemned by Their Own Laptops. And he starts like this. He says, the latest twist in the saga of how the British government banned talk radio host Michael Savage from entering Britain is straight out of the sitcom Yes, Prime Minister, in which a Machiavellian civil servant, Sir Humphrey, repeatedly manipulates PM Jim Hacker into foolish decisions with subtle arguments that Jim never quite grasps. You've got to read this, because to read this is to understand how far Britain has fallen. But he concludes in a more chilling way. What he says is, whatever flaws of taste or opinion Michael Savage or Geert Wilders may have committed, neither man posed any threat to security, to the British way of life, or even community tension. Home secretaries, either Smith or her successor, would be well advised not even to attempt the, quote, robust defense their department promises in response to Savage's slander suit. They are condemned by their own laptops. All the same, it would be fun to see Savage being cross-examined by one of those clever British barristers. There's another article on the website, michaelsavage.com, Michael Savage's favorite New Yorker profiles. It's very funny, and it's from the New Yorker themselves. Madoff, we learn, says, I pulled off the scheme because the feds weren't watching. My question is, which feds weren't watching? Why have they not been indicted? Answer, follow the money. They're probably working for an investment bank on Wall Street. You know, you follow the trail from the SEC, you know where it leads, don't you? Right to Switzerland. This is the Savage Nation. I'll be back. You've heard me say that Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, should be defending me when it comes to my being banned in Britain for no reason. Not only has Hillary not lifted a finger to help me on this issue, it seems like the Clintons' new foreign policy isn't doing anything either. Joining us today for a closer look at Hillary's performance or underperformance as Secretary of State is Niall Gardner from the Heritage Institute.
As Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton has been almost as elusive as the Scarlet Pimpernel. Her profile on the world stage has been significantly lower than that of her immediate predecessors, Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, who were highly prominent figures in their first 6 months in office. In marked contrast, Clinton has struggled to make her mark as international leader and has on several occasions been embarrassingly overshadowed by Vice President Joe Biden on foreign affairs issues, ranging from Israel to Iraq. She has also been marginalized by the White House's appointment of a series of special envoys and special representatives on issues such as the Middle East peace process, Sudan, and Afghanistan-Pakistan. Clinton's low-key and at times overly cautious approach is symbolic of the Obama administration's floundering foreign policy, one significantly lacking in coherence and direction. Her underwhelming address to the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington merely reinforced the image of a confused foreign policy and an American leadership hugely uncomfortable with the idea of a United States as the world's only superpower. Lacking in strength and vision, and extraordinarily naive for a post-9/11 world, Clinton's "See no evil, hear no evil" speech was one of the weakest delivered by a Secretary of State in modern times. It was a speech that could easily have been written by a bureaucrat sitting in Brussels or Turtle Bay, surveying an imaginary world where the United States is merely one of several equal players rather than the most powerful nation on the face of the earth.
Well, the speech seemed pretty naive to me.
The naive principle of engagement lay at the very heart of Clinton's CFR speech. The rising threat from Pyongyang barely mentioned discussion in Clinton's analysis, except for a rather optimistic boast about two unanimous Security Council resolutions with real teeth and consequences for North Korea. The Secretary of State pointedly avoided any direct criticism of Kim Jong-il and his tyrannical regime, and made no reference at all to the fact that North Korea had recently fired a range of ballistic missiles and even tested a nuclear bomb. The mass starvation of millions of North Koreans by the regime in Pyongyang was also conveniently swept under the carpet, as was continuing human rights violations by China and Russia. Nor did Clinton directly condemn Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad by name or any other of the country's Islamist rulers for the brutal murder and suppression of protesters on the streets of Tehran following last month's rigged elections. While conceding that she was, quote, appalled by the manner in which the government used violence to quell the voices of the Iranian people, Clinton made it clear she remained firmly committed to direct talks with Tehran over Iran's nuclear ambitions, and emphasized, quote, the importance of offering to engage Iran and giving its leaders a clear choice. There was no reference to what measures the United States and its allies should take against Iran if it failed to halt its uranium enrichment program, thereby neutering any threats of further economic and political sanctions, let alone the potential use of military power. In contrast to her tough rhetoric on the Iranian nuclear issue when she campaigned for the presidency, Hillary Clinton has adopted a remarkably dove-like tone while in office, extending the hand of friendship to a brutal dictatorship elected through ballot rigging and intimidation. Like President Obama, the Secretary of State remained largely silent during the immediate aftermath of the Iranian elections and, in an effort not to offend the Iranian leadership, completely avoided referring to the re-election of Ahmadinejad as fraudulent. This was a cowardly approach, one that significantly undercut America's image as a great nation that will always stand up for the cause of liberty and freedom in the face of tyranny. The Obama administration has made a greater effort than any U.S. administration in history to extend the hand of friendship to unsavory regimes. There is barely a tyranny on the face of the earth that has not been earmarked for engagement, from Tehran to Caracas to Khartoum. The Obama-Clinton doctrine is increasingly defined by a refusal on the part of the administration to take an aggressive stand against despotism and by the relegation of human rights concerns to the bottom of the well of foreign policy issues.
Her new strategy seems inherently dangerous.
There are many dangers inherent in the strategy, including lending the veneer of respectability to dictatorships that crave international acceptance when none is merited. Such an approach will swiftly undermine the activities of opposition movements and non-governmental organizations operating in repressive societies, organizations that rely upon the isolation of their governments within the international community to seek democratic reforms and political change. This doctrine also buys valuable time for regimes such as Iran to advance their nuclear programs and erodes international pressure to strengthen sanctions. Clinton's underwhelming performance so far as Secretary of State is representative of a U.S. foreign policy that projects weakness rather than strength and is leaving the United States increasingly vulnerable in the face of an array of enemies. She has sorely disappointed those who argued that she would toughen the president's position on key international issues, especially the Iranian nuclear threat. The brutal reality is that rather than strengthening Washington internationally, the much-hyped Obama-Clinton doctrine of smart power is an empty shell that masks a strategy for America's decline as a world power. The long-term strength and security of the United States depends ultimately upon strong defenses, including the launch of a global missile defense system, as well as the advancement of economic and political freedom across the globe. America's position as a superpower has been weakened by President Obama and Secretary Clinton's failure to stand up to tyranny, and their rash embrace of odious dictators will ultimately tarnish America's image. An administration that chooses to appease evil rather than confront it will ultimately decline in credibility, both at home and abroad, in turn leaving the homeland more vulnerable to attack. World leadership is not a popularity contest. Rather, it is about making tough decisions and adopting positions that will be met with hostility in many parts of the globe. It is about the assertive projection of American power, both to secure the United States and to protect the free world. Such leadership is often a lonely and unenviable task that at times will require the use of maximum force against America's enemies. The United States needs stronger leadership on the world stage from both the White House and the State Department, including a tougher stance towards America's foes from a Secretary of State whose voice is unusually meek and silent. This is a time for America to project its might and confront its adversaries, not to retreat behind a failed strategy of engagement.
Niall Gardner, thanks for being on the Savage Nation. San Diego, Jeff, you're up on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, it's a pleasure. I just wanted to call in and give a brief testimony of how you've changed my life. And I know there are thousands that have similar stories, but I began listening to you while doing 3 years in the California Youth Authority, which is basically a prison for youth.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, I got a Walkman. It's one of the things I was allowed to listen to, and I started listening to your station. And
they let you listen to the Savage Nation? How risque of them. They didn't make you listen to rap music in the California Youth Authority?
That or mariachi music. There were very few choices.
Amazing that they let you listen to talk radio. All right, so did you not have a strong father figure?
I did, but he walked out at 15 when I was 15.
There it goes. So, in other words, the radio voice becomes, in a way, sort of the radio father, right?
Correct.
General MacArthur, they gave him a white ticker tape parade through New York City when I was like a kid, 10 years old. And he had just come back from Korea. And I'll never forget, I begged my father to take me in his car to Queens Boulevard so we could watch General MacArthur go underneath on the boulevard in an open car. And I'll tell you the truth, it stood with me for many, many years. He was a hero of mine. Did I know him? No. Did he speak to me? No. Am I General MacArthur? No, that's not the point. Is that we all need role models. We all need something to hold on to in this slippery world that we live in.
Savage.
The media has all but buried any stories on Iran's election and the resulting protests and government crackdowns. We would be getting zero information if not for the internet and websites like Facebook and Twitter. Joining us now is James Carafano to discuss the effect that the social networking sites are having on Iran and the way we can still get information, even when the media doesn't want us to know it.
Well, Michael, thanks, as always, for having me on. You know, all I do is spend my days thinking about the stuff that keeps you up at night. I work on all the bad things. So I work on all the national security issues here at the Heritage Foundation. And one of my continuing frustrations is always how the mainstream media doesn't get it. And then we get a call from you guys, and you say, hey, you need to talk about this because you guys focus on the right thing. And this is a great example. You know, everybody remembers the most important film of all time, Jurassic Park. And when the character says, you know, life will find a way. You know, it's the same thing with freedom and democracy. Freedom and democracy will find a way. And what's going on in Iran now is a great example. But, you know, the mainstream media, as soon as Obamacare came up or the next thing, you know, they were off that story in a New York Minute, and people are still in Iran protesting against the government, pushing back. Democracy is trying to get root and grow leaves, and the mainstream media just doesn't give a damn. So one of the things we did in some of our research here at Heritage is we looked at what a lot of people call social networking or Web 2.0. It's basically how people use Twitter and Facebook and you name it, all these different websites to communicate back and forth with each other, and it had a huge part to play in getting the word out about the Iranian protests both in the country and outside the country. It's an incredibly fascinating case. You know, about a third of Iranians have access to the internet, which is actually the second highest in the Middle East behind Israel.
One third? What's the percentage like here in the West?
For the West, that's actually a very low percentage. In the United States, for example, 70% of Americans have access and regularly use the internet. And so why was this explosion of people Twittering and Facebooking and blogging and emailing? Well, what happened is there's about a diaspora, a population basically kicked out of the country or that successfully got away from the Ayatollahs there, of about somewhere between 3 and 5 million that live around the world. Many of them live in the United States, Canada, Brazil, countries with very high access to the internet, and we know about at least a 500,000 of them are very active online. So what really happened here was is that people in Iran, being very creative and innovative, kind of got the word out to the West, and then the West and the Iranians in the West really got the message out, and this whole thing kind of exploded. And, you know, for those people that, you know, say that government has to do everything, and, you know, we can't trust people, and, you know, freedom thing doesn't work, and, you know, democracy is oversold. You know, look at people in Iran. You know, well, we're sitting here trying to, you know, give our everything to the government, you know, and create a socialist empire under Obamacare. I mean, look what people in Iran are doing, fighting to gain their freedom back, and the imagination, creativity. One of the things it does is about 98% of the political websites in Iran are censored. The government owns the press, which is why people use the internet, but they monitor everything on the internet. They have very sophisticated monitoring tools, and they block access to websites. And what people did is they set up what was called proxy servers, which basically you would just take a computer and you'd make it like a mailbox, a message point, and you'd create a name for it. And of course, the censors wouldn't know that, you know, about that. And so what you do is you would send your message to that server, and then it would send the message outside the country to a blocked server, to a forbidden site. And so you would still kind of get the message through like the old Pony Express.
Mm-hmm.
And doing that, it was really incredible. We saw live video of people protesting in the streets. We saw people tweeting in Los Angeles, telling people where the meetings were in Iran. And, of course, the Iranian government's not stupid. I mean, they're evil, but they're certainly not stupid. One of the things is they actually sent agents online trying to trip people up to get people to register certain things so they could figure out who the dissidents were. They sent out tweeting false information saying, hey, there's going to be a meeting here, so people would show up and they could arrest them, or spreading false information on the internet. And there's you could actually follow this thing. There's actually a site called TwitSpam, which TwitSpam looks for malicious actors on Twitter, and they report on these people online. So they say, hey, don't, you know, whatever that tag is, you know, don't listen to that person. He's an Iranian agent or something. So it's fascinating to kind of watch this online battle of information warfare go back and forth.
I see what you mean.
You know, it's funny, but mainstream media jumped on this news story because the government basically kicked the press out of the country. So we only knew about this through Twitter and Facebook and those kinds of things, and they really ran with it. When that was great, but you know, again, you know, as soon as you know Obama has a press conference, everybody forgets that the world is on fire and there are people out there fighting for democracy, and they jumped off this story, which I think is tragic because today, you know, we have a significant portion of the Iranian people who know that their government is nuts, who know that they're destroying their economy, who know that they're making themselves the enemy to the world by pursuing these nuclear weapons programs, and they don't like it, and they're fighting back. And you know, we've all moved on, and we're watching the summer shows on TV, in part because you know the mainstream media is not talking about this, and it's really sad. It reminds me of kind of the worst days of the Cold War when you know people stood up and the Czech Republic or Hungary and other places and you know made a stab for freedom, and the Soviets just slapped them silly, and in the West we just turned a blind eye. You know, it was only during the 80s when Reagan talked about we have to stand up to the Imperial Empire, and he encouraged the dissidents in Poland and the Czech Republic, and he worked with the Pope, Pope John Paul, to make democracy flourish. And the bad guys just kind of threw their hands up and gave up. And so, you know, contrast with a Ronald Reagan, who would have loved a world of Twitter and Facebook and things like that, and contrast that with Obama, and here's a guy who, you know, has a blog, has a website, loves to Twitter, has a BlackBerry, loves all the social networking stuff. And what is he using it for? Was he out there, you know, promoting freedom and democracy in the world? Was he out there talking about and lauding people on for standing up for their rights and individual liberties? You know, no, he's out there basically marketing Obamacare and cap and trade and whatever other kind of government's going to solve all our problems agenda here. It's really sad to see, you know, freedom striving to get to the light of day and using the internet as what people use coffee houses for and street corners for and during the American Revolution to spread the word of freedom, and to see our government basically turning a blind eye to, you know, Iran and Venezuela and this wacko president that wants back in Honduras. It's really disappointing. I mean, you know, all the time we think about the internet, we think about, you know, people using it for pornography and identity theft and, you know, stupid mindless games and things. And we realize that here is an instrument that also can be the cause for cry freedom. And instead of focusing on that and the wonder of the fact that the voices of freedom and democracy can't be silenced in the world, you know, we're playing games, we're buying stuff off of eBay, and we're reading the president's blog where he's, you know, telling us how he's going to solve all our problems and take all our money.
Thanks for the report, James. Now, I was watching a, there's a couple of channels I'm addicted to on television. I admit I watch, I'm going blind from the internet and television. It's sad. I'm addicted. I can't stop it, but that's the way it is. It's horrible. Everything's blurry. And then I watch military history almost incessantly, and I watch History Channel almost incessantly. And last night on HDTV, I was bored. I watched a thing on the occult in the Third Reich under Hitler that, you know, it's alleged that Hitler was a Christian. And, excuse me, his henchmen were Christians, but you well know and I well know that they weren't. They had been born, of course, in Catholic nations or such, but they were all devout occultists, and they practiced the occult behind the scenes. Most Germans did not know that they were led by an occult maniac, Adolf Hitler, and were surrounded by Satanists. And to this day, they don't understand that they were surrounded by Satanists, nor do the American people themselves understand what was going on historically, because they don't teach any of this. They don't understand that most of the atrocities, not all of them, were carried out by the SS, who answered only to Hitler, separate from the Wehrmacht, which does not mean there were not atrocities conducted by the Wehrmacht, the German army, but it's important for you to understand this, to understand what was going on. These children were brainwashed in a Hitler youth from childhood on. Think about it. If a boy was born in 1920, he then fought in 1938, 1939, 1940. The state had him for virtually his entire developmental life. They brainwashed the child, first in the Hitler Youth, and then in another a program for the teenagers, then finally into the military itself. When I heard that Obama wanted to create a military unit or a special unit of children, a national service children, that will answer only to the White House, every nerve in my body went into overdrive. Do you remember that statement? Listen to it now if you don't. This was during the campaign. Guys, see if you can find that. It's very important for you to hear this. Okay, just say when you have it, whatever. I know I picked it out of the air. I don't expect you to have him. Listen to this, because this could be coming to a neighborhood near you. If you don't have it, you don't have it. But say you have it or don't. You're leaving me in the lurch here. Another 50 minutes, all right. Figure out 9 o'clock tonight I'll have it when I need it. When I'm passed out from exhaustion. Anyway, during the campaign, Obama gave himself away in many different ways. Reverend Wright was perhaps the most telling giveaway of who Obama is inside the head, between the ears, where it counts. You say it doesn't matter that a man sat in a church for 20 years and listened to vile anti-Americanism with a special twist of anti-whiteism? You say it doesn't matter? I say it does matter. I say he could have left at any time and he didn't. And I warned you what was coming. And he also gave this speech. I want you to hear it again. Go ahead.
We cannot continue to rely only on our military in order to achieve the national security objectives that we've set. We've got to have a civilian national security force that's just as powerful, just as strong, just as well-funded.
A civilian national security force that's just as strong, just as well-funded as the U.S. military. That sounds like a little gentleman from Austria who wanted his own civilian security force, and he created it. It was called the Brown Shirts, and he funded it, and they fought for him, and they protected him, and they protected him not only from the political opponents, but from the military itself. And so, ladies and gentlemen, as I say, since this is the new way, since this is the new world order, since there's no stopping the tidal wave of lies, deceit, arrogance, and absolute un-Americanism emanating from the highest office, I think that it's time to get along and go along. And that's why I say today we're rechanging the show to the peaceful nation. Because the last thing we would want is to see me on a watch list of the Homeland Security or the FBI or the CIA. I want them to understand that I'm a team player, that I'm not a loose cannon, that I'll get along and I'll go along. And so, as I say, whatever the government wants of me, I'm willing to do. And I'm even willing to go so far as to myself offer several initiatives, and one of them would be this. Although over the years I've called for stronger borders and the deportation of illegal aliens, I think today I'm going to call for the relocation of all white people who have lived here for more than 50 years in order to give the newcomers from the South a chance, just for the sake of fairness and balance. we should force all whites over the age of 50 to leave the country, perhaps with their possessions, perhaps not, in order to give all of these newcomers from the South a chance, the newcomers who have put all the Democrats in power and have kept them there for these last 20 years. You see what I mean? It's time for them to appreciate the beauties of America, and it's time for those who've enjoyed this fair nation to move on. Time to pack up your kit bag and move along. Now it's time for the callers on the Savage Nation, 1-800-449-8255, Michael Savage. Oh, yes, there's a story on my website that I linked up from the failing San Francisco Chronicle, a newspaper that's losing $1.5 million a week, a million and a half a week. It's not their money. They certainly won't change their policies. They'd rather be out of business collecting crazy checks in the cafes of San Francisco than ever recognize the fact that they drove their newspaper to bankruptcy. So there's an article about bedbugs in San Francisco. Apparently there's a bedbug epidemic in the city, and it's not just limited to single-room occupancy hotels anymore. Oh, no, it's in various neighborhoods now. It's way out of the cheap, poor neighborhoods. The bedbugs have proliferated throughout San Francisco, but there's no mention of where they came from. It's as though the bedbugs were created by spontaneous creation. You've heard of spontaneous emission, and, of course, you've heard of spontaneous combustion. But you've not heard of spontaneous creation yet. But according to the liberal, bedbugs may have been created by spontaneous creation, created simply out of the air in order to make immigrants look bad. I'll be right back. I ate too much for lunch. I'm sleepy. But anyway, so you see, here's the problem. Is when you try to do good for yourself, sometimes you do bad. Take me, for example. I went to an Asian restaurant to eat some lunch. I don't know, you know, the Asian restaurant. I tell them no fat. I mean, no oil or less oil and no sugar. And it usually comes out fairly good. So I finish eating and I'm starving. I had the plate lunch and I'm starving. I go out. I walk right into McDonald's nearby. I said, why am I doing this? I said to myself, why am I doing this? I just ate lunch in the Asian restaurant. Answer, because I'm starving. And I sneakily ordered a fish burger. But then I said, without cheese and without sauce, with extra onions. In other words, I was, it's like the devil on my left shoulder said, have the fish burger. The angel on my right shoulder said, all right, at least cut out the cheese, please. The alarm bells were going off. And add onions to it. Onions. So I said, all right. Then the Mexican woman says to me, do you want the sandwich? I said, what do you mean? I knew what she meant. I said, no, give me the French fries, too. Now, I got to tell you something. With the Diet Coke, with the thing, I scoffed it down like it was a dessert. It was unbelievable after the good Asian meal. Now, there's no moral to the story other than there's only so much you can do in the world that's good for you, you know what I mean? And then at a certain point, you just got to enjoy a meal once in a while. Like last night, I went to a local hole-in-the-wall, disgusting Thai place that no one goes to except a few local people. The food's excellent. We feel very bad for the guy. His children are always in there doing homework. They're very hardworking people, and his food is very good. It's awful. It's like next to a laundromat. There's nothing more depressing than eating in a restaurant, in a mall, strip mall, next to a laundromat. You say, well, why do you do that to yourself? You can afford any restaurant in the city. Answer, because his food is good, and I don't care about style. I care about the food. I go to eat. I don't go to be seen. I don't go to be heard, and I don't go to... certainly don't want to hear people talk, which is, unfortunately, this dump. My luck... at a table nearby in this empty restaurant was a classic Marin County liberal couple from hell. Let me see if I can describe them. Just say, a classic liberal couple from hell. Now, they're in a dump of a restaurant. Every platitude known to liberals came out of that woman's filthy mouth. From global warming, while she's stuffing a fat yap with food, she's talking about global warming. Then she goes on to... did you hear the story about blacks being underrepresented in law firms, Bob? Oh, yes. Blacks get into major league law firms, but they don't make partnership. Blah, blah, blah. So I start to fume. I'm boiling, and I'm trying not to say a word. I'm like behind a tree in this dump, like a cheap tree, a fake tree, and I'm trying not to see them, but I can hear them. And she won't shut up. Now, I got to tell you, I had a few drinks before dinner, and it made me somewhat loquacious. So I started to talk to my... long-suffering Mrs. S, as loudly as I could, to counter the global warming argument and to counter the blacks in the law firm argument. Then I got outright insulting. And, you know, one thing led to another. Eventually they left. Fortunately, they were smart enough to not make it any worse than it was. Why did they have to do a political discourse in a restaurant? Now, I do this for a living on the radio. You have an option to turn the show off or to turn the show on, to turn the volume up or turn the volume down. When you go to a restaurant, you don't want to hear a moron shooting his mouth off about politics. I find it the most offensive thing in the world for people to speak loud in restaurants, by the way. Some of them scream. But some of them scream about political points of view. Global warming, blacks not getting ahead, you name it. You name the issue. And then to top it off, as they were leaving the restaurant, they say to the owner of the Thai restaurant, oh, we're sailing to Thailand or going on a sailing trip in Thailand next week and, I don't know, some whatever, Phuket, I don't know where they were going. And they do the bow with the hands together. He looked at them like they were crazy. He could care less whether they're going there. But you see, they were eating in the Thai restaurant for cultural and social reasons, to bond with the simple people of the third world. So that's last night. That's two in a row. I had the Thai brain beating last night. And then for lunch today, I had to go from the Vietnamese lunch, which was excellent, by the way, but skimpy. I'm not 98 pounds living on a handful of rice, fighting, with the NVA here in the woods. I need a real meal, an American meal. I have a radio show to do. Please, you know, lay it on. This is the Savage Nation. With God's will and your listenership, I shall return.
Savage.
The Savage Nation, welcome, welcome, welcome. 1-800-449-8255 is the phone number from anywhere in the United States of America, including London. Michael Savage's favorite New Yorker profiles, I noticed, was covered in a blog note in the New Yorker itself. It's very interesting. The blogger writes, for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about myself as usual, because if I am not about myself, who will be? And yet if I am only about myself, who am I? So therefore, you have to indulge me. That's what talk radio is about. It's different than any other medium. In other avenues of the media, people try to bury themselves because that's the way it was done by gentlemen over the years. But the world is no longer gentle. And since there are very few men in the media, I'll do what I have to do to survive. Thank you very much. So the New Yorker wrote a profile of me, and I'm actually, it's changing something inside of me. I don't know exactly how yet. I feel something changing in me in some ways, and I have to take time to absorb what this actually means. I don't know whether you think the profile of me was good or bad, positive or negative, real or false. We can talk about that. Nevertheless, it's a milestone in my life and my career. Let's put it to you that way. It is a big deal for me because I grew up reading the New Yorker and profiles, in particular some of the profiles you wouldn't believe that I liked. And we read in today's New Yorker news desk, the blog site, notes on the day by the staff of the New Yorker, Michael Savage's favorite New Yorker profiles, and they say this, and it's very short. Then we're going to go into some other news stuff. On this week's New Yorker Out Loud podcast, I said to Kalefa Sena that I assumed that the conservative talk radio host Michael Savage, the subject of Sena's profile, was not a New Yorker subscriber. Sena corrected me. Savage is a long-time reader of the magazine. Savage confirmed this on the July 27 installment of a syndicated radio show, Savage Nation. Here's what Savage said. I'm reading as a kid now in college, and I'm seeing this profiles. I'm going to go back now to the early list. Profiles of people done by the New Yorker in the times that I was in college. Fellini, 1965. Bob Dylan, 1964. Albert Einstein, 1973. Dizzy Gillespie, 1990. Mort Saul, 1960. Stanley Kubrick is profiled in 1966. Buckminster Fuller is profiled in 1966. One of my favorite profiles, Savage said, was of a guy you never hear of named Joe Gould, who was a well-known Greenwich Village bohemian. I loved that profile so much, it actually stayed with me for ages for some reason. He goes on, he says, so count Michael Savage as yet another Joseph Mitchell fan, and I don't know who he is, I think he puts together the profiles. And he says, Savage Nation yesterday included long excerpts from the Out Loud podcast, which I'll admit sounds better with Savage chuckling underneath, knit together with discussions about Botox, flatulence, the theater, and whatever else came to mind. This was my favorite, he writes. Quote, Savage said, I ate too much radicchio last night, which is so acidic. I'll never eat it again. Can they serve me lettuce, for God's sakes? Why do I have to eat this stuff. Everything's a trick. When I grew up, it was vinegar. Now everything's a trick. Vinegar, it's now $5,000 a bottle, like wine. Why does everything have to be so special? You ask for a cup of coffee, you got coffee in my day. Now it's 50 different varieties. Same garbage with different prices. Macchiato, macchiato, lacamato, lacawana, choo-choo. Savage urged his listeners to buy the current issue. I want them to understand we're conservative and we buy magazines. They are sold out in West Hollywood because friends of mine in Hollywood bought every copy available. They're sold out in San Francisco because they don't sell them in San Francisco. The illiterate left doesn't read The New Yorker in San Francisco. They only read periodicals that favor burning cars and things of that nature. But I'm pleased to report that at least one gentleman in the mainstream media has covered the disgrace of Michael Savage being banned in Britain. And that's a man named John O'Sullivan, who wrote an editorial in the New York Post. John O'Sullivan was once the editorial page editor of the New York Post. They posted his post called Condemned by Their Own Laptops at around 1 in the morning last night. You can't find it anywhere in the New York Post anymore because it's part of the conspiracy to ban any discussion of me by the new Soviet-era conservative press. I mean, we expect this behavior, don't we, from the liberal press? But you wouldn't expect it from the so-called conservative press, would you, when one of theirs is hanging by a thread that they would ignore him? Well, I would expect it because of reasons I have explained on this show over and over again. And I'm going to talk about it later on. But I want you to read Condemned by Their Own Laptops, New York Post, John O'Sullivan. You can find it on michaelsavage.com. I can't locate it on the New York Post at all. I want to read it to you. It's really good. The latest twist in the saga of how the British government banned talk radio host Michael Savage from entering Britain is straight out of the sitcom Yes, Prime Minister, in which a Machiavellian civil servant, Sir Humphrey, repeatedly manipulates PM Jim Hacker into foolish decisions with subtle arguments that Jim never quite grasps. Jim, so we're banning this fellow Savage from Britain because he's a dangerous Islamic terrorist, are we? Sir H, not quite, PM. We're banning him because he isn't a dangerous Islamic terrorist. Jim, I see. No, I don't. Sir H, well, there are a lot of dangerous Islamic terrorists on the list already. It might give the impression we don't approve of them. So we're adding other names to, balance them out and, well, reassure them. Jim, balance, huh? So this Savage is dangerous in other ways. Sir H, indubitably, PM, he's a conservative shock jock radio broadcaster. Jim, I don't know what that is, but it doesn't sound especially dangerous. Why did we say we're keeping him out? Sir H, consults document. I think the phrase is, quote, likely to cause community tensions, PM. Jim, is Savage likely to cause community tension? Sir H, not really, sir. Nobody in the community has ever heard of him. Both laugh. Jim, well, they'll hear of him once we ban him. They laugh again. Sir H, but it'll be for the one and only time. They fall over laughing. So then John O'Sullivan goes on with this great column, and he says, So it would have been if a shrewd old Mandarin like Sir Humphrey were still running the Home Office in Whitehall. He'd never have made the elementary error of putting the real reasons for banning Savage in a confidential email. He'd know that the final destination of confidential Labour government mail is the front page of the Conservative Daily Mail, which is where the internal Home Office emails relating to Savage's exclusion from Britain ended up this week. Savage himself is owed most of the credit for exposing this latest farce. He decided to fight his exclusion by launching a slander suit against the Home Secretary, the hapless Jackie Smith, who has since resigned amid an avalanche of gaffes, and then obtained his own list of incriminating emails as part of the legal process. These emails are fully as silly and damaging as anything in Yes, Prime Minister. One makes it explicit that Savage is being named as an excluded person, quote, simply to ensure that the names disclosed are not all Islamic extremists, close quote. Another email discovered reveals that the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, and the Foreign Secretary, David Miliband, are, quote, firmly behind this naming and shaming. A third email from a civil servant who seems a potential Sir Humphrey prudently warns his bosses that all this sounds too much like, quote, duplicity. Indeed, it does. The list of named and shamed included not only Islamic extremists, but also two Russian skinheads imprisoned for 20 racial murders. What had Savage done to justify including him in such company? The worst that the cautious Home Office official could cite was that he was, quote, homophobic, which isn't a crime even in San Francisco, the birthplace of Savage's radio show. And why proclaim his exclusion when he had shown absolutely no sign of wanting to enter Britain? The answer is that naming and shaming Savage was a low exercise in cheap politics, all too characteristic of the Brown government. Its methodology is similar to the recent scandal wherein a Gordon Brown aide had to resign on being found spreading false rumors, also via email, that opposition Tory leaders and their families were mired in various sexual sins. Those were false. You hear? It had another low political motive as well, as that of appeasing radical Islamism, namely attempting to discredit conservatives by associating them with extremists and political criminals. Exactly the same tactics, guilt by association and guilt by exclusion, were later used against Geert Wilders, the anti-immigration Dutch politician. Whatever flaws of taste or opinion they may have committed, that's Wilders and Savage, neither man posed any threat to security, the British way of life, or even community tension. Home Secretaries, either Smith or her successor, would be well advised not even to attempt the robust defense their department promises in response to Savage's slander suit. They are condemned by their own laptops. All the same, it would be fun to see Savage being cross-examined by one of those clever British barristers. That's by John O'Sullivan in the New York Post, although you can't find it there anymore. It's on michaelsavage.com, entitled Condemned by Their Own Laptops. Although it would be fun to see Savage being cross-examined by one of those clever British barristers. Yeah, it'd be fun to hear the high-class accent trying to get the best of this shock jock, who too many people think is incapable of nuance and subtlety. Now, speaking of nuance and subtlety, I'm going to ask some questions on the Savage Nation that I think are nuanced and subtle, such as this. Why is it that the right wing in America generally never talks about arts, culture, science, poetry? Why is it that the right wing can only discuss politics to the exclusion of arts and culture? Do so-called conservative commentators today think that their audiences are so uneducated that they could not even discuss such matters? Or are these commentators, the right-wingers in America, just uneducated themselves and afraid to admit it? I have discussed, for example, my walks through great art museums. I've talked about scientific papers, whatever comes to my mind. I sometimes talk about the great novels of Western civilization. I talk about music, from jazz to the classics. And yet you never hear such topics coming out of the mouth of the golfer or the ears of the hemorrhoid. Why is that? I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Savage Nation. It's sort of like cheerleaders outside a sporting event, that bumper, you know. Isn't it? Ba-ba-ba-boo, be-ba-ba-ba-bee. It's, you know, it's already July 29th. Give me a break. Ba-ba-ba-ba-boo, be-ba-ba-ba-bee. So here we are, condemned by their own laptops. It's a slam dunk case, or is it? And the New Yorker is a big deal. It's changing me in certain ways inside in that. I think, to me, it's a milestone in my life. I can't explain how it's going to affect me. And only one person in the mainstream media has understood how important this British case is. Now, locally in San Francisco, a blogger named Big Vinny, who is a liberal apparently, has been covering this because he understands that it's a bigger issue than Michael Savage. New York, not one article written about me. It's funny with all the big mouths in the media and all of the girls with Botox lips who care so much about the Constitution, who wrap themselves in just so many flags it's hard not to notice their lipstick, because it blends in so well with the red stripes of the U.S. flag. How come none of them have seen fit to cover this? It's unbelievable to me. Vivian in New York City, go ahead, please. You saw it today in the New York Post. What page? Vivian, go ahead, please. Gone with the wind. Bingo. All right. 1-800-449-8255. We can move on. Support the Savage Legal Fund if you want. Madoff says, I pulled off the scheme because feds weren't watching. Now, here's what I want to know. Madoff says he was able to steal $65 billion because the feds weren't watching. Can anyone explain why not one Fed has been indicted yet? Answer, because they're working for Obama or one of the investment banks that got the money. They will all be at Martha's Vineyard this summer, high-fiving each other on a tennis court with Obama present. What, are you kidding me? If we're living like in a banana republic right now, it's a small version of what's coming to this nation. We're becoming like a South American nation. The level of corruption has never been like this. It's like Diamond Jim Brady took over the White House. But, you know, okay, Madoff did this during other, you know, regimes. He did it during Clinton, during Bush. Didn't matter. He owned them. He smeared so much money around. What, Schumer didn't get any? You're telling me Schumer didn't get some of the spinoff of the Madoff scam? And that's why there's no investigation. Why is Chris Cox, for example, of the SEC, and I'm not accusing him of having taken any money or having done anything illegal at all. Why is it that Bush's head of the SEC, Christopher Cox, ex-Republican congressman, has not yet been indicted? Well, he's probably innocent. That's the only thing I can conclude. Innocent until proven guilty. Yeah, that's the American way, particularly if you own the government. The New Yorker article was a turning point for me in the sense that it was the first media depiction of Michael Savage that truly captured the artistry of Michael Savage as well as the polemics. While others focus solely on isolated polemics taken completely out of context, this article in the New Yorker captured in many ways the entirety of who I am as a talk show host and as a man. Now, what's interesting to me is there are some of you out there who refuse to believe that a left-leaning magazine such as the New Yorker could possibly do a fair job of covering me. So here would be my question to you. Do you think that the New Yorker profile has diminished my influence amongst my conservative base because it shows me as being a more whole man? Or do you think it's going to increase my audience to a larger level by pulling in some people from the other side? I don't know. I have something to admit to you, though. No, I want to go back to that for a minute. The left today controls the culture. But it's not a natural phenomenon that the left should own the culture. Why is it that the conservatives are sort of atonal when it comes to music, literature, science, poetry, art? Why is that? In other words, you rarely, if ever, hear a talk show host on the right discussing, I mean, we're not NPR, but there is a larger world than Obama, Marxism, etc., right? There's a larger world in talking about health care incessantly day in and day out. So what I'm saying is, as an educated man myself, I tend to occasionally talk about these things. Why is there almost no discussion of anything except these tinny little subjects by the golfer, by the wall banger, by the hemorrhoid? The answer is because they never went to college. Don't you understand? They're a stereotype of what the left says about them. They're not bad people, don't get me wrong. But they're incapable of anything else.
Savage.
It is a crazy, mad, mad world. There's no question about it. Everyone's out to get everyone else. And there's no friendship. That's the beautiful part. Once you know that, you're liberated. Everyone will disappoint you. Not because people are inherently bad, but because it's the fault of the apple, as was written by a fiction writer 40, 30 years ago. Goldman, was it Goldman who wrote it? The fault of the apple. He said it was the fault of the apple. He was so right. I'm guilty of it. I mean, I'm sure I disappoint everybody I know one way or the other. I try not to, but how can you not? How can you not disappoint somebody just being a human being and trying to get through a day? Right? So, you hear what we're talking about already on the show. The other last night I watched, remember I told you I was flying back from Florida and I bought the DVD set Mad Men Season 2? And I watched it till my eyes almost fell out. Then I told the pilot, pull it out of the DVD player. So now we bought season one of Mad Men. There's something weird about January Jones. In some scenes in season two, she's as gorgeous as Grace Kelly. And then there's some bad cuts where she gets a little puffy. She looks like a different person. She's almost like the three or four faces of Eve, that woman. She can range from superb, like high, you know, high-class Connecticut woman. She's best when she puts on the riding uniform and goes riding in Connecticut. But there's some other scenes where she's so dowdy-looking, I don't understand how she could be the same person. I mean, I'm not drawing a bigger conclusion here. I just don't understand as an actress how she can have so many faces. But then that opening scene, the graphics of Mad Men on AMC, where the graphics of the ad man falling out of the building, the cartoon, you know what I mean? Wow, that's really good. In that, you know, it was one misstep and you fell out of the you fell out of your career. But has anything changed from the days of the man in the gray flannel suit? Has anything changed in any business today related to the media? I have fallen out of a building five times now, and I'm still functioning. I can go back over my career Five times people have tried to throw me out of a window. I mean, you know, I don't mean throw me out of a window literally. No one's Superman. Five times I bounced back to where I fell from. Or I climbed back or I crawled back on the building with suction cuffs in my hands. What can I tell you? It's because it took me all my life to get there. No one's getting rid of me so fast. And many of them would try to get rid of me, wound up getting rid of themselves, like Jackie Smith. She tried to push me out of a window, and right now she's out of the window. And I can name five other people in the media who went after me from day one in local stations who are no longer heard of. And I'm making a statement right now. Somebody up there likes me, number one, or I wouldn't be here, number two. And number three, all of you who are out to get me in the media, particularly you conservatives, I will outlive you in the media. I'm telling you right now, I'll be here long after you're gone. I may be 20 years older than you, but I'm telling you as I stand here, I'm going to be here long after you're gone. I'm making that commitment right now. Keep pushing, because you're only playing judo with yourself. You're going to wind up falling out of a window. New York City, WOR, 1-800-449-8255. Gabe, go ahead, please. You're on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Mr. Savage, from formerly of Brooklyn, I live in Long Island now.
Yes, sir.
You just talked about the Jake Sullivan article.
Yes.
And I get three papers for the last 60 years. I get the...
So where is this article by John Sullivan condemned by their own laptops? Is it in today's Post? If it is, what page?
Page 29.
Where is it? Next to a Brazier ad or next to a... Where'd they bury it? Next to some, smut parlor in the Bronx?
Before you get to the editorial, the page...
Oh, shocking. Shocking. It slipped through the censors of the New York Post. How did that happen? Gabe, thanks for calling. That's all. San Diego, John, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Michael Savage in a British court, that would be great. That would be like a pay-per-view moment. I mean, I'd pay money to see that, like a UFC fight. You had to promote it and make some money off it for
well,
you.
Well, I understand what they would try to do, because the opposition would try their Eton accents on me, thinking they're going to run a number by me that, you know, I sound like a longshoreman or a truck driver. I'm some just shock jock they're going to run over. And I know what would happen. These guys would be very embarrassed after the interchange.
All right.
No, I'll tell you, if we do the documentary movie on me, we'll film it in a British court if I get that far. Or we could put out the, remember the thing with the French fries, we wouldn't eat them anymore? Remember that phase when the French were anti-American? How about putting out a product called Fish and Brits, where we get a mold and we cut potatoes in the form of little Brits and we fry them? That might be a big hit, Fish and Brits. Huh? Axelrod's son hired by Huffington Post. Ugh, God, take a look at this prize. You know who Axelrod is, isn't the guy with the mustache, the pencil mustache, who looks like a guy who works for the UJA from the Bronx? What kind of man has a son who has to go to work for Arianna Huffington when it isn't even her name? I mean, she took the name of the oil man that she married for his money, in my opinion. You know, what's her background in Greece? Does anyone know Arianna Huffington? She comes from Greece. Her family allegedly was anti-communist or anti-fascist. It's hard to say. But everybody knows that she was a woman who had cash registers in her eyes. Arianna Huffington was once a conservative when it suited her, and she married Mr. Huffington. He's a very nice man. I actually met him when I was a local talk show host, and he ran for governor, and he came in the studio. Very nice guy. I actually met her. She wasn't a bad person. And then she turned and wound up on Saturday Night Live, as long as I can remember. And she was on the air with Al Franken in bed playing some silly charade. And then she became a liberal because that's where the money was. That's the direction she went in. So now she has some kind of website that no one reads except diehards who look like the movie Pat. And now we realize that she hired one of Obama's minion sons? Can you believe this? Yes, I could believe it. Where else could the kid work? I mean, McDonald's is full up. The illegal aliens have the jobs that he would normally get. New York City, WOR. Norm, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Mr. Savage. You were talking about why the Republicans don't seem to be talking about the arts.
Yeah.
I'm an artist in New York City. I'm also an art teacher. And I noticed that most of the artists on the grassroots level in the galleries, they all tend to be liberals, leftists. I'm rare among them. And you got the perfect example of 1937 when Johnny Rockefeller II, he hired this guy, Orozco, who was a painter, to do his mural in
Rockefeller hired Rothko to do his murals. That's how he got to fame.
Well, no, he was top guy. So he hired a creative guy, and he tried to paint Lenin in one of those murals, which he did. These guys, the painters, tend to be leftists. The guys up on top who would give the grants, who spend the money, they tend to be mostly Republicans, are not too good in art, and they have a little bit of envy in them because they're not artists. So who runs?
Yeah, but why don't the conservatives who have the money demand more from the artists? Why are all the artists so left wing? Why is it that they don't understand the basics, which is that when repressive regimes arise, as they have in Venezuela, the artists suffer? Don't they put two and two together that the left today is the danger, that there is no right at all in this country? There's absolutely no right-wing government whatsoever. There's no right-wing waiting in the wings in this country. Where is it?
It's gone.
The Republican Party isn't the right-wing. They're the Republican Party.
Absolutely right.
The true party of liberation is a party of one. That's what I've been trying to say with my show for these years. A party of none is also a liberation, to not belong to either of these machines. Thanks for the call. Whatever. John in Connecticut, line 5, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Yeah, how you doing, Michael? One of the reasons why we don't listen to or expect to hear the arts and entertainment from you and others is basically we're getting from other places. And you know, I can get my arts and entertainment and go to museums and get that type of thing from other sources, and it's pretty unspinnable from my perspective. We listen to you for direct commentary on politics and finance and other things like that.
Okay, I understand that, but what if a person who is on the right side of the dial, as I am, goes to a museum or an art show and I talk about it? Why is that not of interest? In other words, seeing an art show from the conservative perspective, I'll give you an example. San Francisco once had a pretty good set of museums here. Most of them have been taken over by radical leftists who put on some of the most abominable exhibitions imaginable, such as a series of dresses and clothing worn by some old woman who had a lot of money. They actually put on an exhibit of the woman's shoes, her dresses, her clothing. And I went there, and I think rather hysterically ripped the exhibit apart. I thought that was political and artistic.
I agreed. I know there's a lot of other examples of that kind of garbage out there. And, I've heard about it in New York City. Occasionally there's been art shows where we've heard all about them. But,
well, that's what I mean. I'm not going to just talk about art to sound intellectual or to sound like a pseudo-intellectual, but when they do an exhibit in a museum about a woman's shoes, I couldn't believe what I was looking at. And I said, this is an example of what's going on in museums today. Now, that's what I mean by covering the arts. Now, of course, in passing, I'll also talk about one of the finest oceanic collections in the world, which happens to be in the museum here, but the best one is in New York City, the Rockefeller collection. You've probably seen it yourself.
And we appreciate the interjection occasionally, but for the most part, mainly we're looking for, the direct...
All right, so what you're saying in a nice way is lay off the art crap and stick to politics.
I don't mind the art commentary occasionally, but I can get that from other places. What I can't get is direct commentary on politics. It's always spun in other places. That's why we come to you.
Listen, here's the thing. I come on late in the day in New York on the East Coast. I come on late afternoon in the Bay Area on the West Coast and in between the rest of the country. You've heard it all. Haven't you heard it by now from the golfer, the wall banger, and the hemorrhoid? Haven't you heard everything about health care, or you don't have the time to listen earlier? Is that what you're saying?
We get it a little bit, but you give us a little bit different perspective. We appreciate your perspective on things, the way that you bring in your background with the botany and things
like that.
All
right, so you want me to focus almost entirely, as I've done for 15 years, on politics and lay off the other stuff?
Labor occasionally, but I do...
I hear you. I don't know if I can do it anymore, though. I'm making an admission, John. I think after 15 years of it, I'm bored of it. I find politics extremely boring. We know look, let's talk about the basics. Obama is a Marxist. Everything about him, if it walks like a Marxist, if it talks like a neo-Marxist, it is a neo-Marxist. Why was it fair game to call conservatives who were behind Bush neocons? Why can't we call Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel and all of the others around Obama what they are, which is neo-Marxists? The answer is because we have no control over the print media in this country. They are neo-Marxists, period. I mean, the slur neocon went on for years when Bush was in power, right? Yet we now have a stalking horse communist regime running this country. Some of them are overt communists, some of them are mild communists, some of them are light communists. There's not one of them who is an American from my point of view. Every one of them is trying to disassemble this great nation. But I've said that over and over again, John. Thanks for the call. New York City, WOR, Mo, you know Schmo, you're on the Savage Nation, Mo.
Hi, Mike. I just wanted to ask why they call you a shock jock when all you do is tell the truth. Has the truth become so shocking?
Because in order to try to diminish what power I have, whatever power I may have, in order to diminish the intelligence that I may show on this show from time to time, they have to try to marginalize me by calling me a shock jock, but I've taken it as a joke now. I said, go ahead, call me shock jock, see if I care. Call me shock jock at the risk of your own embarrassment. That's all I can say. And by the way, when have you last seen a shock jock profiled in the New Yorker? Have you ever seen one profiled yet?
I have to tell you that I don't have television by my own choice. And
again, no answer. Wait, hold on. Do I have bad technology? Can you answer the... No one hears me. I found it yesterday. I listened back to the show. I torture my family by making them listen to the replay. like when I say something to a caller, they don't hear me. There must be a delay running the other way or something. I have the longest time delay in the history of radio. Most people have 7 seconds, then they made it 16 seconds. I think now the time delay is 30 seconds. So I think it feeds back the other way, too. I'm not sure. I really don't know what the issue is. I say A, they're talking about C. I say C, they're talking about A. 1-800-449-8255. Okay, condemned by their own laptops. That's the latest twist in the saga of how the foolish British government banned talk radio host Michael Savage from entering Britain. It's an article you should print in the New York Post. It's on michaelsavage.com. And this piece shows